their lives. I'm writer and broadcaster Ridian Brooke, and this Good Friday I am exploring the impact that the last days of Jesus have had on the lives of people today. Good Friday Meditation with me, Ridian Brooke. On Good Friday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 31st of March. Good morning, this is Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb.
Good morning, the headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer has told the BMA, the Doctors' Union, they have 48 hours to call off a strike by resident doctors in England or face losing 1,000 extra training places. The Israeli Prime Minister predicts that the Iranian regime will collapse internally, as he says the war is at its halfway point.
Also in today's programme, will new rules stop the policing of everyday arguments? No more sexism in the kitchen? We'll be talking to a Michelin star chef who wants to stamp it out of the restaurant business. And in the words of that great thinker and savant, Winnie the Pooh, you can never tell with bees, but you can listen in just before 9 to hear about a new documentary showing a side of the insect you may not have seen before.
The bees vibrate their wings together to generate extreme heat. The temperature in the centre reaches 115 degrees, hot enough to fry a hornet.
BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
Resident doctors in England are being given 48 hours by the Prime Minister to call off their planned six-day strike or face losing 1,000 extra training places. The industrial action is due to begin next Tuesday, the 15th walkout in a long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The expansion of training posts has been a key part of negotiations between the government and the doctors' union, the British Medical Association. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Exchanges between the doctors' union and ministers have tended to get more acrimonious as a strike gets nearer, and the Prime Minister has intervened before to criticise the BMA for staging walkouts. This time there's a threat to ditch part of a proposed pay deal if the strike isn't called off. Writing in The Times, Sir Keir Starmer has criticised the union's decision to reject an offer as reckless, made worse by failing to put it to members, as well as an average 4.9% pay increase, including changes to pay scales. The government promised to create extra training places for doctors to advance their careers. Implementation of 1,000 of these was due to start in April, but the Prime Minister says this won't happen if the strike takes place next week. The British Medical Association said with the NHS under pressure, creating posts and improving patient care should not be dependent on calling off a strike.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the war against Iran has achieved more than half of his military aims. He also said the attacks by his country's forces and the US were weakening Iran's leadership. The Israeli military says its latest wave of airstrikes have targeted regime infrastructure in Tehran. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
With energy prices soaring, the question of when the Iran war will end is a pressing one. But speaking to the US channel Newsmax, Benjamin Netanyahu declined to give a timeline for achieving Israel's war goals. After 1 month, he said the war was definitely beyond the halfway point, but later clarified he meant in terms of missions, not time. The Israeli Prime Minister said the war had killed thousands of members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and that his country and the US were close to finishing the arms industry, wiping out entire plants and the nuclear program itself. The Israeli leader again said that regime change was not the goal, but he voiced confidence that the Islamic Republic would collapse internally.
Four Israeli soldiers have been killed during fighting against the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Two others have been wounded. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting following the deaths of three peacekeepers in Lebanon in the past 2 days. Israel says it's investigating what happened. Kuwait says one of its oil tankers was directly targeted by an Iranian drone while in Dubai. Reporting from there, our correspondent Lorna Gordon.
The tanker Al Salmi, which the Reuters news agency reported had been en route to China, had been at anchor in Dubai when it was attacked. It was fully loaded with 2 million barrels of oil from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The vessel was hit by a drone just after midnight, setting it on fire and damaging its hull. There were initially concerns about a possible oil spill. The situation is being assessed. No injuries were reported amongst the ship's crew. Overnight, missile and drone attacks and defensive interceptions were also reported in Sharjah in the UAE, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Reports from Iran, meanwhile, say that an Iranian parliamentary committee has approved plans to impose a toll on shipping, hoping to use the Strait of Hormuz. Around a fifth of the world's crude oil normally passes through the narrow stretch of water in the Gulf.
A BBC investigation has heard from parents who believe the wrong sperm or egg donors were used during their IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. Clinics there have become popular among British people seeking fertility treatment abroad. The British Fertility Society says incidents like this should never happen, and this is an appalling situation for families to be in. Anna Collinson reports.
Our BBC investigation has discovered that the parents of at least seven children believe that the fertility clinics they paid in northern Cyprus used the wrong donor sperm or donor eggs in their IVF treatments. Most now have completed DNA tests, including one family who've had it confirmed that their two children are not biologically related. Northern Cyprus, which is only legally recognised by Turkey, has its own laws and doesn't have an independent fertility regulator which monitors clinics. Its Ministry of Health hasn't responded to our findings.
You can hear the full story on File On 4 Investigates on BBC Sounds now or on Radio 4 at 8pm tonight. Police in England and Wales will no longer record what are known as non-crime hate incidents. The College of Policing, which provides guidance to forces, says a fundamentally different approach will make clear that lawful free speech isn't a police matter. More details from Sam Harrison.
Non-crime hate incidents include single events such as arguments or abuse on social media, which cause harm but are not illegal. Until now, they were still officially recorded by police. But from today, that requirement has been scrapped. Instead, the Home Office says a new common-sense-led approach will be introduced, meaning officers will only attend and record a hate incident if it might help prevent a crime or fulfil other key policing purposes, such as protecting life and property or maintaining public order.
New rules are now in force intended to ensure all households in England have a weekly food waste collection. The aim is to increase recycling, but BBC research has found that a quarter of local authorities won't be able to comply with the regulations.
Caroline, thank you. It's 7 minutes past six. The weather was getting colder, we were told. Has it got colder already, staff?
It's actually turning milder for the next couple of days. And Nick, yes, it's going to be influenced by high pressure through today and tomorrow. And that's going to bring largely settled conditions for the majority. It will be rather cloudy at times with limited sunshine, but still feel mild for the time of year. If you get the sunshine, though, we could be hitting the high teens in a few places, certainly through today. However, as we move towards the end of the week and into the Easter weekend, this is where we start see the temperatures coming down a little bit. The jet stream will strengthen, that'll allow areas of low pressure to move in, bringing more unsettled weather with an increasing chance of some gales, particularly across northern and western parts of the UK. Still some uncertainty on this, so you have to stay tuned to the forecast and the run up to the Easter period. Today, though, it is mostly cloudy across the country. The cloud thick enough at times to produce some patches of drizzle over northern and western hills. But like I mentioned, as we head into the afternoon, we'll begin to see some cloud breaks developing, and that'll allow for some spells of sunshine, particularly to the east of higher ground. Now, winds will be light, mainly from the west or the northwest. And like I mentioned, even if it's cloudy for you, it's going to feel relatively mild this afternoon. Temperatures range from 11 to 15 degrees, but up to 16 or 17 where we get the sunshine for any length of time. Tonight, the cloud will persist for many with light winds. Where clear spells develop, patches of fog may form thanks to those very light winds. So the far west of Scotland, the northwest of Scotland, will turn windier and wetter as we head towards the early part of the morning, because we'll see a new weather front working in. A mild night, temperatures between 5 and 9 degrees. Scotland, Northern Ireland tomorrow will become wetter and windier through the day, but England and Wales, another quiet day, mostly cloudy with a little bit of sunshine. It'll be mild.
Thank you for that. 8 minutes past six. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Mirror has further claims about the sacking of the Radio 2 breakfast show presenter Scott Mills. Mills crisis for the BBC is the Sun's headline. The paper says corporation staff were left stunned as the news of his departure broke. According to the Daily Mail, it's believed that his sacking, announced with what's been described as a curt public statement, was one of the final acts of the BBC Director General, Tim Davey, who reportedly wanted to clear the decks before leaving his job on Thursday.
The Daily Star says bookmakers believe Gary Davis is the favourite to take over from Scott Mills as the permanent host of the Radio 2 Breakfast Show. He's certainly presenting it from this morning. He's described as the natural safe pair of hands. The Mail also name checks Vernon Kay, Sarah Cox, Greg James, Trevor Nelson and Ryland Clark. Could Chris Evans be tempted by an emotional return? Asked the Daily Telegraph, adding, stranger things have happened.
The Times reports that the Chancellor is in line for a multi-billion pound tax windfall as the war in the Middle East drives up energy prices. Analysis by the paper suggests the government's making about £20 million a day in additional revenue through levies and taxes linked to the price of oil and gas. Government sources have warned that any extra funds generated could be offset by the cost of borrowing.
Labour urged to help Britain's drivers now is the headline in The Express. The AA has warned the Prime Minister not to delay. The IA leads on his number 10 summit with business leaders, in which he urged them to limit the fallout from the Iran war.
And we'll be hearing from a Treasury Minister at 10 past 8. There are still 48 hours left to choose a better path, is the message in The Times from Sir Keir Starmer to resident doctors. In England, we used to call them junior doctors, ahead of next week's strike. The Daily Telegraph calls his remarks an ultimatum, a direct threat to those considering walking out. But the paper also points out that his tough stance threatens to open a rift with the Labour left that has, in the past, supported NHS strikes.
We will hear from the leader of the junior doctors just after 7 o'clock. It's now 6:10.
And as we were hearing in the news, a fully loaded tanker has been hit overnight in harbour in Dubai. Lorna Gordon is our correspondent there. What can you tell us, Lorna?
Yeah, the tanker was in the waters off of Dubai when it was hit by what authorities described as a drone attack. It had been en route to China's, Reuters news agency reporting, fully loaded with 2 million barrels of oil from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The attack took place just after midnight local time, setting the ship on fire, damaging its hull. There were initially concerns about a possible oil spill, but within the last few minutes, the local authorities here in Dubai say the situation has been assessed and that no oil is reported in the waters around the tanker. No injuries also reported amongst the ship's 24 crew.
It is an escalation, though, isn't it? Because there have obviously been attacks right across the Gulf, and attacks that have been that have affected civilian infrastructure. But this feels like, as a deliberate ploy, something new.
Well, yeah, the alerts go off in the Gulf states every night. You get those warnings on your phone to take shelter overnight. Missile and drone attacks and defensive interceptions were reported in Sharjah in the UAE, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. But of course, one of the big global concerns is trying to get oil and gas through that pinch point, that choke point on the Strait of Hormuz. Some are getting few, a very small number, but the number of ships passing through are vastly reduced. And of course, any time a tanker is attacked, that raises the concerns of those oil operators, makes them pause just a little bit more about whether or not they should risk that passage. And of course, this is a big, significant tanker, a huge tanker, fully laden, and the fact it was targeted in an obvious and deliberate attack will be raising concerns both amongst the countries here in the Gulf and the tanker operators as well.
And just to reiterate, the Dubai authorities saying in the last few seconds that the oil tanker the fire has been contained, there is no oil leak and there are no injuries as well. Lorna Gordon, thank you.
It is now 13 minutes past six. Here we go again. On the front pages of many of this morning's papers is the word BBC, scandal and crisis, and the photograph of a presenter who has been sacked. Lizo Madzimba, our entertainment correspondent, joins us. Scott Mills is a big name in entertainment. He may not be for regular Radio 4 listeners, though. What makes this scandal different, Lizo, is he was sacked pretty much before anybody knew that there was an alleged scandal, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I think that is something that the BBC will be hoping the public and audience will recognise. There have been crises in the past where there's been a drip of allegations day after day, and people asking what is the BBC doing about this, and public anger and mistrust building up. In this particular case, as you say, the first we really knew about it was after the BBC had acted, and I think the corporation will be hoping that they will be seen to have lived up to what they've so often promised, that no matter who someone is, the BBC will deal with them if it decides the circumstances do demand action.
The BBC is saying very little about what led up to this sacking. It's the Mirror that led the reporting on it, saying that the allegation related to a historic relationship.
Yes, the Mirror originally broke the story yesterday, saying it relates to a historic relationship going back more than 10 years. BBC News has not been able to confirm that, and all the BBC have said in a public statement is, while we do not comment on matters relating to individuals, we can confirm Scott Mills is no longer contracted to work with the BBC. But Acting Director General Roderick Telfer Davis has told staff that while he hoped people would understand he couldn't give more information, he did recognise that the news would be a shock to audiences and to people at the BBC, given Scott Mills' profile and the sudden nature of the announcement of his departure.
Lisa Mazimba, thank you.
It is 6:15. The car finance industry is considering its response to the plan to compensate the millions of drivers who were missold finance agreements. Sean is here with that and the rest of the morning's business news. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yes, so many of these loan agreements, they were the ones that the regulator found included commission arrangements where a car dealer received a fee from lenders based on the interest rate charged to the customer, and the arrangement not often disclosed, hence the mis-selling in certain situations. And the regulator saying that then provided this incentive for a buyer to be charged higher interest rates than necessary, so leaving them paying too much. So I reckon around 12 million deals could be included in this, could cost about £7.5 billion in compensation. Shanika Amarasekara is chief executive of the Finance and Leasing Association that represents the motor finance sector. Good morning to you. Do you accept these proposals now after all this time?
Good morning, Sean. We received the FCA's final scheme yesterday evening, so we're still working through what is a substantial set of proposals. For us, the principle is clear. Where people genuinely suffered loss, they absolutely should be compensated. But at the same time, millions of families and businesses rely on motor finance every day to keep their lives and the country moving. So any scheme has to be fair, proportionate and workable. And
what does proportionate mean? Isn't fairness just if you have missold, then people should be compensated for the deal that they were missold?
Yeah, what really matters here, Sean, is keeping motor finance affordable and available for the families and businesses who rely on it every day.
Is that what really matters here, though? If there's been a run of mis-selling, isn't what really matters the fact that those that did wrong had to have to make that right?
Yeah, the important thing here is making sure that people who genuinely lost out are treated fairly. And we're pleased to see that the FCA has acknowledged that and moved in the direction from the consultation. But there's a lot in the consultation that came out yesterday, and we need more time to really understand the full impact on customers and on the market.
You're sort of giving the impression that you think that maybe the regulator isn't thinking that it's just people who have had a financial hit that should be compensated here. You think it's going beyond that, do you?
So the scheme that was announced and consulted on in October last year, we believe did go beyond that. And now what's happened is that there have been changes made by the FCA, some quite significant changes, and we welcome those changes. And we need to just make sure that we understand the full impact on customers and on the market of now what's been announced yesterday evening.
What's the proportionate issue that you have with this? A lot of people might think, what has proportionality got to do with it? It's something has either been missold or not.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Sean. And what that means for us is that this shouldn't create a windfall for those customers who didn't actually suffer a loss. So it's great to see that what the FCA has done in the scheme that was announced yesterday has acknowledged some of those things that we believe weren't proportionate. So, for example, if you got car finance and you had a 0% interest rate, then that wouldn't have been unfair. So you shouldn't receive compensation then. And it's things like that that we refer to when we say proportionality. But there's a lot in the scheme still to digest to see if we believe it is currently proportionate or not.
Do you see any evidence that this can limit the deals that might be on offer, that it might now push up costs on some of the products that are out there?
Well, that's the bit that we really want to talk to our members, who are the motor finance lenders in this space.
Well, you've had a long time to do that now. That's not something that needed the announcement last night. People have, we've seen lenders put millions and millions aside for this kind of stuff. So we know there's some admittance of the mis-selling there, and that they may have to compensate. But is that impacting deals?
Well, what really matters, as I said, is looking at the long-term affordability of motor finance and its availability. And so looking at the scheme that was announced yesterday, how much is it going to cost lenders and how does it affect them? And making sure that that long-term affordability and availability continues. That's what I mean when we say we have to talk to our members and look at what the market impact is, and making sure that those who lost out are treated fairly and do receive redress, but it's not a windfall for those that didn't, and that motor finance continues to keep households and businesses moving in the UK.
Can I put this to you from Kevin Durkin, who's the solicitor at HD Law, and he brought actually one of the first car finance cases to the UK Supreme Court last year. This is what he had to say.
I think the economy is dynamic enough to cope with this, and lenders just simply need to cut their cloth accordingly. I'm sure they've enjoyed the huge, egregious profits they made from the financial mis-selling scandal. And if they had to scale back a bit because they need to pay out compensation or effectively hand over money that they shouldn't have taken arising out of unfair relationships, then so be it. I do think it was doomsday talk from the industry to try and gain some traction with the FCA, and it's clearly worked. But the starting point is, it's the consumer, and this also seems to be lost in the mix. It's the consumers being treated unfairly. They need the money more than the car finance industry.
It was doomsday talk, Shanika.
That actually, this is about the market impact. What we don't want to see happen here, Sean, is that businesses and households don't have access to affordable motor finance in the future. That's what's important for us. So I'm not sure I can agree with the doomsday talk. I think we need to look at what the longer term impact is. And just and one of the things that we do welcome from yesterday's announcements from the FCA is the creation of a task force across regulators, the Advertising Standards Agency, the Solicitors Regulation.
I'll tell you what, Shanika, a lot of people will be thinking, why does there need to be another task force? I've been asking, some people have put in, you know, requests to these lenders for compensation for years already now and had so many barriers put in their way. It doesn't really feel like the industry has been thinking about the consumer as a priority along this route.
Well, I think we stand behind the fact that those people who lost out must be treated fairly. And that's the principle that we've always held at the FLA. The question now is, how do we deliver a scheme that is workable, that lenders can get money into consumers as quickly as possible, but keep motor finance affordable and available?
Shanika Amarasekera, thank you very much for your time. Chief Executive of the Finance and Leasing Association. Will Walker Arnott with us this morning from Raymond James Wealth Management. Good morning to you, Will. Let's have a check-in. We've got this far without talking about oil prices and things so far this morning. And actually, people might be waking up seeing them a bit lower than they were when they went to bed last night. What's happened overnight?
Yeah, there has been a little bit of a fall in the oil price, but I think we should go back to the fact that the oil price over the last 24, 48 hours has hit two very important psychological levels for the US administration. Number one, Western Intermediate Texas has moved above $100 a barrel, which is an important level. And number two, at the pump, it's now costing nearly $4 a gallon to fill up cars in the US. And so this will be hurting the Trump administration. And we see rumours overnight that actually President Trump is considering pulling out of the war. This is according to the Wall Street Journal, even if the Straits of Hormuz haven't opened up. So markets continue to gyrate. The Trump administration continues to vacillate. And so there is continued uncertainty in the markets.
Gyration and vacillation. I'll use those words a bit more in the coming days, I think. Well, just in terms of the impact on the UK as well. So you mentioned how Donald Trump politically might be reacting to these higher prices. But, you know, the International Monetary Fund warning that the UK could be one of the biggest, have one of the biggest hits from these higher oil prices. How has that led to the investment world viewing the state of the UK economy, the cost of borrowing for the government?
Yeah, if you compare UK debt with the US equivalents, we normally look at the 10-year borrowing cost. In the UK, it is bobbing around 5%, which is a significant premium to the US, where it is about 4.3%. Actually, yesterday, the eye of the market turned from, for the first time over the course of March, it's been completely concerned about inflation risk. But actually, yesterday, we saw a rally in sovereign bonds, the UK gilts and US treasuries, as actually people began to concern themselves with growth prospects. Was the rise in oil price going to hit growth, and was that going to mean that actually interest rates may have to actually start falling to compensate?
So a rally in bonds means those interest rate expectations actually coming down a little bit, so the
correct
the yield on
but,
those bonds.
But I should just point out that in the UK the market is still expecting 2.5 rate hikes over the course of 2026, which in our mind seems a little excessive, but it has come back a bit over the recent days.
Will, thank you. Will Walker, are not there. One place that has seen a big price rise recently has been aluminium, hitting four-year highs. Tom Uppington is the managing director of the only primary aluminium smelter in the UK, Alvance British Aluminium. Tom, good morning. What has been the impact in recent days?
We've had a significant number of approaches from customers looking to see if we can increase our output just with the squeezing of demand or supply coming out of the Middle East.
So, yeah, we've seen these Iranian airstrikes on two major Middle East producers that have sort of increased a bit of a supply shock. Are you able to meet the demand of others that are turning to you?
We can't at the moment, just due to energy prices in the UK. The way we are set up, we have our own hydropowered energy generating station, which supplies sufficient energy into our smelter to allow us to produce at 70% of maximum capacity. But if we were to move to having to increase that smelter output and buy energy off the grid, it's just not competitive for us to do that.
So if you can't actually meet that demand, does it, at some point, does it mean we could be on for an aluminium shortage in the coming months?
I think if you look at the market data, there's definitely a shortage coming. In the 20 years that I've been in aluminium, the LME inventories that are in the warehouses around the world are as low as I've ever seen them.
What are the consequences of that? Which industries get hit first, do you think?
I think most industries will be hit. You'll just see as the market tightens, premiums will increase. And because these premiums and the aluminium prices traded globally, if industry wants to buy the material, they need to absorb the costs.
Important in construction industry, car manufacturing, electric vehicles, solar panels, and plenty more as well. So, crucial metal. Tom, thank you for that update. Tom Uppington there, MD of Alvance British Aluminium.
And Sean, thank you very much indeed. Coming up to 27 minutes past six, here's Carthy with the Sports News. Morning, Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. Things move pretty quickly in football, don't they? Tottenham Hotspur have now entered into advanced talks with Roberto De Zerbi, the former Brighton manager, who is now willing to take charge of the club immediately. It had been thought his preference was to wait until the end of the season to see which league Spurs might end up in, but Tottenham have moved to agree an immediate deal and talks are being described as positive. The England football manager, Thomas Tuchel, says he's disappointed but not angry with players that have withdrawn from the squad before tonight's friendly with Japan. Declan Rice and Bukayo Saka are amongst those that have dropped out of the England squad since Friday's 1-1 draw with Uruguay. The BBC's John Murray has details ahead of the final England camp before the deadline for naming World Cup squads.
It's England's last match at Wembley before the World Cup. The next time they play, it'll be June in Florida in the tournament warm-ups, by which time the final 26 will have been decided. So this is the last chance in an England shirt to stake a claim. Although the nine who were fit enough to join the split squad on Saturday are pretty sure of their places, and likely most of them will be in the starting lineup tonight. Certainly the captain, Harry Kane, will be. It's been agreed with Japan that up to 11 substitutions can be made, and on a March spring night at Wembley, we might see water breaks to give the players and coaches an idea of how those might work and be used in the expected sweltering conditions in the summer.
There's commentary of England versus Japan on Five Live Sport tonight. Scotland face Ivory Coast at the Hill Dickinson Stadium after they were booed on Saturday following a 1-0 defeat to Japan. The Scotland manager, Steve Clarke, was surprised by that reaction after what was Scotland's first game since qualifying for the World Cup for the first time in almost 30 years.
I think over my time in football, the more you do, the better you are, the more people expect from you. So I think I'd rather have it that way than people not too bothered about whether you do well or not. So yeah, if the expectations rise and the levels rise and that level of expectation rises, that's fine. We can handle it.
Wales missed out on World Cup qualification, losing their playoff semi-final on penalties last week, but they still have to fulfil a friendly fixture tonight against Northern Ireland, who also missed out on World Cup qualification. And at Snooker's Tour Championship in Manchester, world number one Judd Trump beat Mark Allen 10 frames to 8 to go through to the quarterfinals, where he will face Sean Murphy.
Cathy, thank you.
My name is Jamie Bartlett, and I'll be looking at how fakery took over the world and asking why no one seems bothered.
No, no, hang on, sorry. You're not Jamie Bartlett. I'm Jamie Bartlett.
Well, who am I then?
Well, I'm afraid you're not real. You're Jimmy Bartlett, an imitation chatbot I've created to help me make this series on modern fakery, in which I'll be asking why it's no longer punished and often rewarded.
Sounds good. What's it called?
Everything is fake and nobody cares. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
That sounds too good to be true.
Time now is 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Nick Robinson. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The Prime Minister has given resident doctors in England 48 hours to call off their planned strike or lose 1,000 extra training places. The six-day walkout is due to start next Tuesday and is part of a dispute over jobs and pay. The expansion of training posts has been a key part of negotiations between the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association and the government. A Kuwaiti oil tanker in the port of Dubai has been hit by an Iranian drone. All 24 crew members are said to be safe. Overnight, Iranian attacks have also been reported elsewhere in the region, including Israel, where the IDF said its air defence systems were intercepting incoming missiles. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that more than half of his military aims in Iran have been achieved. He also said the US-Israeli attacks were weakening Iran's leadership. Mr. Netanyahu was speaking on US television after President Trump threatened to, as he put it, obliterate Iranian infrastructure. Parents have told the BBC that they believe IVF facilities in northern Cyprus used the wrong sperm or egg donors in their treatments. British people looking for fertility treatments are increasingly turning to services in the territory. The British Fertility Service described the families' situations as appalling. The Home Office has announced that police in England and Wales will no longer record so-called non-crime hate incidents, such as arguments or abuse on social media that's not illegal. The Home Office says a new common-sense-led approach will be introduced, meaning officers will only attend and record a hate incident if it might help prevent a crime or fulfil other key policing purposes. New rules designed to increase recycling are in force, with councils now required to provide all households in England with a weekly food waste collection. BBC research has found that a quarter of local authorities are not ready to provide the service.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It is now 28 minutes to 7. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has predicted that the Iranian regime will collapse internally. He said this as Donald Trump was reported by the Wall Street Journal to be considering ending the war, even if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened to oil tankers. What are we to make of all this? Let's join our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell. Morning to you, Yolande. Let's begin with those comments by Benjamin Netanyahu. How does he see the war's progress so far?
Well, he chose his words very carefully, speaking to Newsmax, this US conservative cable channel, really declining to give a timeline when he was pressed on that. But he said that the war was definitely beyond the halfway point. But then he said that that was in terms of missions, not in terms of how long it would actually take to complete. I think really Israel is leaving those big announcements to President Trump himself. But Mr. Netanyahu listed what he said were achievements of the war, including killing thousands of Iran's Revolutionary Guards members. He said that, you know, the US and Israel were close to finishing the arms industry in Iran, that they were wiping out entire plants. They targeted the nuclear program itself. And when it came to that subject of regime change, again, he was careful. He said, you know, that this was not the goal, but he said that it had been weakened by all that happened. And he was hoping, really, that it would collapse internally.
careful, no doubt, because it's hard for him, it's hard for anybody to keep up with what Donald Trump is saying as it changes every single day. Meantime, though, there are behind-the-scenes reports suggesting that Donald Trump wants out and relatively quickly.
Yeah, this is from the Wall Street Journal, quoting somebody in President Trump's inner circle, saying that, you know, he is prepared to end the war even at the cost of leaving it without the Strait of Hormuz fully opened, which has been, of course, his demand. In fact, you know, the ultimatum that he has been giving the Iranian leadership. You can see other ways in which President Trump has also been trying to sort of like change the narrative. He's been arguing as well that they've effectively enacted regime change by killing so many, if not all, of Iran's top leaders.
Yelena Nell, in Jerusalem. Thank you.
26 minutes to 7 as the Prime Minister's here, scrambling to keep the consequences of the war from hitting us all, even when they have already. Let's talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, who's on the line. And Keir Starmer, once again, calling together industry leaders with a view to what?
Well, that is a very good question, Justin, with a view to the government having a clear grip of the situation, even as they don't yet know openly, they don't yet know quite how serious the situation economically is going to become here in the UK. Today, the Prime Minister is chairing a COBRA meeting in government. COBRAs are crisis meetings. But, you know, this is a crisis that the government still does not know the full shape of. I think the fact that the Prime Minister is holding this meeting a day after, as you say, he chaired that industry roundtable in Downing Street is designed to convey that he is on it, that he is looking at the economic consequences of this conflict as well as participating in diplomatic activity around it. But as with yesterday's roundtable, we are still not expecting anything to come out of this. I mean, there are broadly two areas where I think people expect the government at some point to announce measures. One is household bills. We saw Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, acknowledging that last week and talking about the shape that any household bill package would take, targeted rather than universal. And then there's any action they could take on prices, in particular fuel prices. But those still, I think, some way off.
Yeah, well, which is interesting, isn't it? Because are they or are they not feeling the pressure on reducing, for instance, VAT on fuel, which quite a few governments have just done. Just looking at a list at the moment of governments that have either capped prices or reduced VAT, etc. Spain, for instance, reducing VAT on electricity bills to 10%, etc., etc. Is it that they feel that they don't need to do these things at the moment, or is it just that they are not able to work out what it is that is best at this moment?
No, I think it's that the government, you know, speak to people in government, they are hopeful that things will get back to normal soon, but I think realistic that they probably won't. And they believe there will come a point where some measures, not necessarily those ones that are being called for by their political opponents, but there will come a moment where some measures may well be taken by the government. But I don't think they feel that they are at or indeed even incredibly near to that moment yet. I mean, as you say, there is a call from Kemi Badenoch, for example, the Conservative Party leader. She's written to Keir Starmer ahead of this COBRA, reiterating her view that he should cut VAT on energy bills, similar position from Reform UK. Then on the other side of the political spectrum, you have the Green Party, Zach Polanski, calling for a much more expansive package of support, saying that if energy bills rise, the government should cover that rise, funded through tax. And the Liberal Democrats also calling for a more expansive package of support. So I think there will be a furious political argument over what the government does. It's just that the government hasn't done it yet, so the argument kind of hasn't started
right.
yet.
Well, we might start it at 8:10 when we talk to a Treasury Minister. Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It is now 23 minutes to 7. One argument that has started indeed, has been going on a very long time indeed, is the argument between ministers and junior doctors, or what are now called resident doctors, ahead of another strike. Yes, yet another strike coming up after Easter. And the Prime Minister this morning has given the BMA, the Doctors' Union, 48 hours to call it off, or, he says, risk losing an offer to create 1,000 extra training places. Our health correspondent, Nick Triggle, can explain what's going on. They were mighty close to a deal at one point, weren't they, Nick? So why has it come to this?
Well, these training posts were a crucial part of that deal that was on the table just last week when talks broke down and the British Medical Association announced the 15th walkout of this long-running dispute. Now, these training posts are due to open in August, and they're speciality posts that resident doctors move into at year three of their training. So it's a point when they specialise in general practice or surgery, for example. And the government says the 48-hour deadline reflects the fact that applications for these training posts need to open in April. And so writing in the Times newspaper, the Prime Minister said it was reckless to turn down the deal. The deal also involves covering out-of-pocket expenses for things like exam fees, faster pay progression, and over the next 3 years, another 3,000 posts on top of the 1,000. So he wants the BMA to put that deal to members, and that's why he's given this deadline.
And they claim, the BMA that is, that the government changed the goalposts, moved the goalposts at the last minute in terms of how fast they got extra payments.
Yes, that's right, Nick. They say the ministers at the last minute came in and watered down elements of that deal, although it seems no coincidence that the talks also broke down as the government accepted the independent pay review body's recommendation that all doctors, not just resident doctors, get a 3.5% pay rise from April. The BMA call this a crushing blow, and while not mentioning the Iran war, the union cited global events saying they were due to push up in inflation. Resident doctors have had pay rises totalling nearly 30% in the last 3 years, but the BMA argues that pay is still a fifth lower than it was in 2008, once inflation measured using the RPI measure of inflation is taken into account.
Nick Triggle, our health correspondent, thank you. We'll hear from the BMA at just after 7 o'clock.
Quick look at the papers, and quite a few of them focusing, of course, on what the government, in their view, should be doing at the moment. The Telegraph, as you might expect, particularly ill-disposed towards what the government is doing, or indeed, as we were hearing from Henry Zeffman, is not yet doing. Labour is clueless on how to solve energy shock, their commentator Ben Marlowe says. He's particularly critical of Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, who was in the weekend round of the studios, saying people should be reassured ahead of the Easter holidays just to carry on as things are, seemingly oblivious, the Telegraph says, to the irony of how anxiety-inducing such words are.
Talking of anxiety, there's anxiety for the BBC from many front pages because, once again, they have the word scandal, BBC and presenter, along with a photograph of Scott Mills, the DJ who hosts the Radio 2 breakfast show, or rather did until last week. He will not be on air. If you switch channels now, you'll get someone else instead. Mills crisis for the BBC is how The Sun puts it, the Daily Mail. BBC crisis as another, helpfully written in red, the word another, scandal hit presenter is sacked. But what's interesting when you read the coverage, though, is when they describe him as scandal hit, it implies that it was known for a very long time. Certainly colleagues of his on air, including Jeremy Vine on air yesterday, said that no one had known anything about it until the sacking itself was announced.
Let us turn at 19 minutes to 7 to other matters. Northern Cyprus is a popular place for couples to go for fertility treatment, but the BBC has talked to families who believe that the wrong sperm or egg donors were used during their treatment. Let's talk first to Anna Collinson, the reporter for Phylon 4. Anna, what have you discovered?
Yeah, morning. So Northern Cyprus is only legally recognised by Turkey and has its own fertility laws. But unlike the UK, it does not have an independent fertility regulator which monitors clinics. And we've found this loose regulation means clinics are able to push the boundaries further compared to, say, the UK. They boast high success rates at low costs. They offer controversial procedures such as sex selection. They also promise a vast array of sperm and egg donors from around the world. If you go to social media, you'll see patients sharing their positive experiences. But we've uncovered a more disturbing side. The families of seven children have told us they believe they were given the wrong sperm or egg donors during their IVF treatments at clinics in Northern Cyprus. Most of them have now completed DNA tests. Now, fertility specialists say these type of errors where incorrect sperm, eggs or embryos are used should never happen. And if it ever does, it should be immediately and thoroughly investigated. But when these families contacted their medical teams in Northern Cyprus, they were met with either silence or denials. Now, we've also approached Northern Cyprus's Ministry of Health, whose job it is to monitor these clinics, and they've not responded to our questions. Ultimately, this is a story about families who want the truth for their donor-conceived children, and it's about the children who have a right to know about their ancestry and where they come from.
Yeah, and because they've had the DNA test, there's no real... Then this isn't a claim that they're making, is it? It's factually the case.
Well, it depends with different families. I think the family you're about to hear from, they've completed not only a commercial DNA test, but they've also done a second accredited test, which can be used in UK courts. And that test has confirmed that their two children are not biologically related. The other test suggests that it's likely that the incorrect donors have not been used.
What does the clinic say? I mean, you said earlier that they've been met with silence broadly. Is anyone in any kind of official capacity in Northern Cyprus saying anything about this?
Well, we've approached people from across Northern Cyprus. We've been working on this story for a year now. As I say, we've tried to contact the Ministry of Health, who monitors clinics. We've contacted fertility specialists. We've contacted lawyers. You name it, we've contacted them. And it's been mostly silence. We have heard from one lawyer and activist, a woman who's been raising awareness about scandals in Northern Cyprus for years. She lives there. And she has raised concerns about the lack of regulation. She says there's very little pressure on clinics to uphold standards. She said that Northern Cyprus is a place where they really benefit from fertility tourism, people coming there for fertility treatments. Mm. And so she says there's no real pressure on these clinics to uphold standards, unlike in the UK, for example.
Anna Collinson, thank you. And as you say, we can also talk to two of the people affected. So Beth and Laura are on the line, two mothers. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hello.
You needed a sperm donor. How certain are you? And we were hearing from Anna that you've taken at least one test. How certain are you that the sperm provided for each pregnancy was different?
Oh, as certain as we can be. So we've had the tests you can buy over the counter that showed that very clearly, but also having the accredited tests that Anna just mentioned. And the feedback from the specialist who led the test was as certain as can be that our children aren't biologically related. It is a different sperm donor for each child.
And when you went back to the clinic and told them this, what reaction did you get?
We've had no reaction at all. We've just had silence.
What will the impact be, do you think, on your children now?
I think for both of them, they're quite angry and confused about what's happened. For them, it's an important part of their identity because it's half of their genetics. But in terms of the family, it probably isn't going to affect us that much, is it?
No, I think, you know, we're very much a family unit and we love each other and that won't change. But for the children in that sense of who they are and who we thought they were, with knowing the donor that we chose and the information we had available, it's been quite an impact for them.
Do you think that it is something that the British government ought to get involved with, or officials here? Because, I mean, obviously Northern Cyprus is a separate place, and as we were hearing from Anna Collinson, it's very separate. It's only recognised by Turkey. Is there anything from the outside world, do you think, that can be done to prevent what's happened to you happening to other people?
I don't think that's something that we'd really thought about, to be honest. I mean, I know that... obviously, the laws over there are different, but I think the thing that could be changed is perhaps looking at case law to be able to put it through the courts so it is changed so that in the future that there is more legislation.
It's also the advice, I suppose, given to people who are thinking of going there.
Yeah, maybe there's something is we're understanding more about this. You know, we've very much been on this journey only recently and having the DNA tests and having that sort of fact and evidence there that this has happened. But I guess our concern is how many other people might be affected, we don't know. So if there is something on that large scale, then absolutely, if people in our country are aware, then some kind of messaging that could shape that and let families know when choosing a clinic would be helpful.
Look, Beth and Laura, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us this morning. And I should say that Beth and Laura's doctor denies any wrongdoing, and the clinic, as we were saying earlier, just hasn't responded to any questions.
It's coming up to 12 minutes to 7. Donald Trump's latest threats against Iran would amount to war crime upon war crime. That is not the latest social media salvo coming from Tehran, or indeed a critic of the war back at home. It is the considered view of a man we often hear from on the programme, the defence editor of The Economist, Shashank Joshi, who joins us now. Good morning to you, Shashank.
Good morning.
War crime after war crime. What induced you to say that?
Well, I think we've seen many really aggressive attacks in this war on both sides. But what we saw yesterday in a social media post by Donald Trump was a threat, not just a repeated threat to attack Iranian power plants and other infrastructure. It was also specifically a threat to attack Iranian desalination facilities. And desalination facilities in the Middle East are absolutely vital for the survival of the civilian population, not just in Iran, but also particularly in the Gulf states. And under international law, under the laws of war, it isn't permissible to attack infrastructure that is vital for the sustenance of the civilian population for the express purpose of causing that suffering and for collective punishment. That isn't allowed. There is no indication in Donald Trump's threats that these facilities are military necessities, that these are somehow war-making objects for the state in the way that you could perhaps argue certain power facilities are. These really do seem to be civilian objects that are threatened for no more reason than their importance to the Iranian state.
He goes on in that tweet, doesn't he, to say this will be in retribution for our many soldiers and others that Iran has butchered and killed over the old regime's 47-year-old regime of Iran, I'm sorry, of terror. How do you analyse why he's saying it? I mean, is this all part of the mad theory of deterrence, not just mutual assured destruction, as it used to be known, but that idea that if a leader looks mad enough to do anything, you simply can't make a rational calculation if you're his enemy?
It's the opposite of deterrence. Deterrence is when you say, if you do X, I will do Y. This is something what we, I guess you would call coercion, or what Thomas Schelling, the political scientist, called compellence. It's the idea that says, I will do X unless you do Y. And of course, what Donald Trump is trying to do, the Y, is open up the Strait of Hormuz. And I think we're seeing these increasingly bellicose threats from the president because he's running out of options. He, of course, as we've been discussing on the program, has ground forces heading into the region, Marines and airborne forces and special forces. But I think he doesn't really want to have to send them to conduct a ground invasion of Iran, which for obvious reasons is extremely difficult, costly, and has uncertain effect. So he's trying to make these threats to see if he can get that outcome another way. We know he's already threatened to blow up in Iranian power plants, starting with the biggest, as he said about a week ago, and that hasn't had an effect. The ground forces on the way haven't had an effect. He's still not seeing Iran capitulate, and he's casting around, therefore, for ever more aggressive and belligerent threats. And I think that's taking him to this.
Yeah, beyond morality, beyond legality, there'd be a problem anyway, wouldn't there? Which is that Iran could attack the desalination plants in the Gulf, making life impossible for millions of people in the region.
There are no permanent rivers, I think, across the Arabian Peninsula. There's groundwater, but that's severely depleted. And if you look at a country like Qatar, it depends on desalination plants for 99% of its drinking water needs. The figures are very, very high in many other Gulf states as well. These facilities are overground. They are vulnerable to attack. And if you destroyed them, you could render uninhabitable the Gulf states. Iran knows that. Everyone knows that. And therefore, I think the Gulf states will be deeply troubled by overt threats like this to introduce attacks on really vital infrastructure.
Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, thanks for joining us.
And that brings us to 8 minutes to seven. Millions of drivers who were missold car finance agreements are to get compensation, but the amount they're getting is being criticised by some as inadequate. Let us talk to Nikhil Rathi, who's chief executive of the Financial Conduct Authority, and indeed a man we have talked to about these things before during the quite lengthy course of the moment, I suppose, that it finally arrives and the money goes into people's pockets. Morning to you.
Morning, Justin.
When it does go into people's pockets, what is the average sum going to be and what is the arrangement?
We put out our final rules yesterday. 12 million agreements will be eligible. On average, £830 compensation per agreement. We think the cost to lenders will be around £7.5 billion of compensation, and it will cost them around £1.6 billion in operational costs as well. We think that millions of people should get compensation this year, and we're encouraging people to complain now if they're concerned, because if they do that, they'll get their money sooner.
Right, so what is the eligibility then?
At the heart of this is whether key information was disclosed by lenders and dealers when consumers took out car loans. And in many cases, that did not happen. The discretionary commission arrangements were not disclosed. That is where the dealer had the ability to change the interest rate and get more commission for doing that. Sometimes very high commissions were not disclosed either. And the Supreme Court's been clear on that. And we are clear lenders have broken the law, and it's now time to put things right.
And how would you prove, though, that something had not been disclosed to you?
The lenders will have an obligation to look at all of their customers during this period and identify who is eligible for compensation all the way back to 2007.
So it comes from the lenders, effectively. They will say who is and who isn't.
So you can complain.
Because that's one of the criticisms, isn't it, of the scheme, that actually the homework is being marked, as it were, by the people who committed the breaches.
So you can complain to your lender and you'll get your money sooner. At the same time, lenders will contact you and you can opt in if you have not heard from your lender by the end of August 2027. If you feel your lender is not respecting our rules, you can complain to them, and there is a free-to-use financial ombudsman service that will resolve any disputes. And we'll be supervising things closely and holding lenders' feet to the fire to make sure that they follow the rules. Consumers do not need to use a claims management company or a law firm who may take 30% of your compensation.
It's quite important, that, isn't it? Because there are going to be all sorts of efforts now to get people to sign up to people who say, well, we'll do it all for you. You're strongly advising them not to do that.
Look, there are vested interests on all sides here. So lenders obviously want to keep the bill down. Claims management companies and law firms want to take 30% of your listeners' compensation. We have no skin in the game as the FCA. We want a free-to-use scheme that gets millions of people the money they're owed.
What about the argument that is made by, for instance, the consumer rights law firm Cormax Legal, who say under the scheme people are going to receive much less compensation than they would have got in court because you have accepted too much from the lenders themselves when it comes to their involvement and their ability to say who and who gets the money, but also more widely, you've done a deal that protects them to a degree that they shouldn't be protected?
We've had over 1,000 responses to our consultation, many consumers, consumer groups, and their representatives and lenders as well. And we've come up with a balanced, fair, proportionate scheme, which is in line with the law, which makes sure that customers are fairly compensated, but that only those who are eligible for compensation do get that. And we should not overcompensate because that would be out of line with the law of the land. We don't accept the claims that this is vastly undercompensating consumers. As I said, there are many law firms out there who would like to get 30% of any compensation, and the scheme we've put forward is free to use and will not involve any fees.
It's also worth saying, isn't it, that at the time you were deciding all of this, there were real fears in the industry, particularly in some companies, that actually the actions you took could put them into real financial difficulties and have and thus that eventually affecting consumers.
Millions of people rely on motor finance every year. And what we have made sure throughout this is that the market remains strong. Last year in 2025, there was a 6% increase in lending in the car finance market. In February, new car sales were at a 22-year record high. And we're seeing new entrants in parts of the motor finance market as well. So lenders need to put things right. They need to do it promptly now, get behind this. And then we can draw a line under this and make sure this market works well in the future.
Are you confident they won't do it again?
Absolutely. We have put in place new rules. Our consumer duty, which raises the standards, disclosure standards have changed. And we think we can get ahead of this to make sure something like this does not happen again. This was breaking the law all the way back to 2007. And that's why we want it fixed so we can move forward.
Nikhil Rathi, Chief Executive of the Financial Conduct Authority. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's look ahead to this Thursday on Radio 4, where we explore more ways to keep your money safe.
Scam Secrets is back for a new series.
The manipulation starts very subliminally.
I'm Shari Vahl. I investigate fraud for the BBC. Each week, I dissect the techniques criminals use to steal your money.
Hey, Shruti, I missed you a lot.
We associate so much fraud with the male voice, but the female voice we trust for various psychological reasons.
Please call me.
From romance and investment scams to one targeting online holiday bookings.
It was actually over 1,800 euros.
Exposing the fraudster's tactics to help keep you safe. Scam Secrets starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Thursday lunchtime at 12.
Here's Stav with the weather.
Thanks very much, Nick and Justin. Good morning to you. High pressure's building in across the country today and tomorrow, and that's going to bring largely settled conditions for most. So the next couple of days look like the quiet period of this week, because as we push towards the end of the week into the Easter weekend, the jet stream will fire up and that'll steer low pressure systems in towards our shores. That'll bring unsettled weather, increasing chance of rain and also gales, especially across northern and western parts of the UK. However, some uncertainty still remains on this, so stay tuned to the forecast or head online, check your BBC weather app day by day. Today, though, it's going to be mostly cloudy across the country. Cloud thick enough at times to produce some patches of drizzle. Western Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northwest England, Northwest Wales favoured to see most of the rain. But most places will stay dry. And through the afternoon, we will see cloud breaks appearing, especially to the lee of high ground. So northeast Scotland, parts of northeast England, and maybe east of high ground in Wales, favoured to see the best of any sunny spells. And where we get the sunny spells with this milder air mass coming in from the southwest, we could see temperatures hitting 16 or 17 degrees. But for most, we're 11 to 15 Celsius. So that is pretty mild for the time of year, despite all the cloud. Tonight, it will stay rather cloudy for many with very light winds. Where any clear spells develop, then we'll likely see some patches of mist and fog, which could be quite extensive in places, especially England and Wales. The far west, northwest of Scotland will turn windier and wetter towards morning as a new weather front arrives, and a mild night to come, 5 to 9 degrees. Tomorrow, Scotland, Northern Ireland will become wet and windy through the day with snow on the hills. But for England and Wales, it's another mostly dry, though largely cloudy day with occasional bright or sunny spells. Mild in the south, turning cooler in the northwest.
Stav, thank you for that. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 31st of March. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer has intervened in the dispute with resident doctors, telling their union to call off next week's strike in England or risk losing extra training places. Israel's prime minister says the war against Iran is beyond the halfway point and is predicting the regime will collapse internally. And Kuwait says a fully laden oil tanker has been directly targeted in an Iranian drone strike.
And coming up in the next hour, something to ponder if you're on the school run this morning.
I think of the moon kind of as a training ground for going to Mars. The children of today, particularly, you know, the young children in primary school, are the age of the astronauts that will go to Mars.
You and any budding space explorers you know can hear more about how tomorrow's Artemis mission to the moon could get our kids to the red planet. That'll be at 10 to 8. And never mind Mars, ferry commuters in Scotland have been facing disruption and frustration just trying to get to their families for Easter. We'll find out why at 20 past 7. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Resident doctors in England are being given 48 hours by the Prime Minister to call off their planned six-day strike or face losing 1,000 extra training places. The industrial action is due to begin next Tuesday, the 15th walkout in a long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The expansion of training posts has been a key part of negotiations between the government and the doctors' union, the British Medical Association. Last summer, there were 30,000 applicants for about 10,000 jobs. More details from our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Exchanges between the doctors' union and ministers have tended to get more acrimonious as a strike gets nearer, and the Prime Minister has intervened before to criticise the BMA for staging walkouts. This time there's a threat to ditch part of a proposed pay deal if the strike isn't called off. Writing in The Times, Sir Keir Starmer has criticised the union's decision to reject an offer as reckless, made worse by failing to put it to members, as well as an average 4.9% pay increase, including changes to pay scales. The government promised to create extra training places for doctors to advance their careers. Implementation of 1,000 of these was due to start in April, but the Prime Minister says this won't happen if the strike takes place next week. The British Medical Association said with the NHS under pressure, creating posts and improving patient care should not be dependent on calling off a strike.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the war against Iran has achieved more than half of his military aims. He also said the attacks by his country's forces and the US were weakening Iran's leadership. The Israeli military says its latest wave of airstrikes have targeted regime infrastructure in Tehran. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
With energy prices soaring, the question of when the Iran war will end is a pressing one. But speaking to the US channel Newsmax, Benjamin Netanyahu declined to give a timeline for achieving Israel's war goals. After 1 month, he said the war was definitely beyond the halfway point, but later clarified he meant in terms of missions, not time. The Israeli Prime Minister said the war had killed thousands of members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and that his country and the US were close to finishing the arms industry, wiping out entire plants and the nuclear program itself. The Israeli leader again said that regime change was not the goal, but he voiced confidence that the Islamic Republic would collapse internally.
Four Israeli soldiers have been killed during fighting against the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Two others have been wounded. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting following the deaths of three peacekeepers in Lebanon in the past 2 days. Israel says it's investigating what happened. Kuwait says one of its oil tankers was directly targeted by an Iranian drone while in Dubai. None of the crew was hurt. The fire on board is now out. Our correspondent Lorna Gordon reports from Dubai.
The tanker Al Salmi, which the Reuters news agency reported had been en route to China, had been at anchor in Dubai when it was attacked. It was fully loaded with 2 million barrels of oil from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The vessel was hit by a drone just after midnight, setting it on fire and damaging its hull. There were initially concerns about a possible oil spill. Overnight missile and drone attacks and defensive interceptions were also reported in Sharjah in the UAE, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Reports from Iran, meanwhile, say that an Iranian parliamentary committee has approved plans to impose a toll on shipping, hoping to use the Strait of Hormuz. Around a fifth of the world's crude oil normally passes through the narrow stretch of water in the Gulf.
Syria's President Ahmed al-Sharaa is paying his first visit to the UK, during which he's expected to hold talks with Sir Keir Starmer in Downing Street. Over the past year, the former rebel commander has been attempting to develop closer ties with Western countries. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
President Sharaa's visit comes at a difficult time for the Middle East and for Syria. The war with Iran is heaping economic pressure on a country struggling to recover from its long civil war. The repeated closure of its airspace, interruptions in the supply of natural gas, and the sudden return of large numbers of Syrian refugees from neighbouring Lebanon are all making life difficult for a leader hoping to attract foreign investment to speed up his country's revival. Ahmed al-Sharaa is doing his best to stay out of the war, conscious that regional instability, whether in Lebanon or Iraq, could spill over his borders. He's busy shoring up relations with the West, visiting Paris last May, the White House in November, and Berlin just yesterday.
A deal between the UK and France, designed to reduce migrant crossings in the Channel, is due to expire at midnight, with as yet no agreement on renewing it. The current scheme has been in place for the past 3 years and sees Britain pay the French authorities to carry out beach patrols in northern France. It's understood negotiations are ongoing and in the meantime operational cover will continue. Police in England and Wales will no longer record most non-crime hate incidents. The College of Policing, which provides guidance to forces, says a fundamentally different approach will make clear that lawful free speech isn't a police matter. More details from Sam Harrison.
Non-crime hate incidents include single events such as arguments or abuse on social media, which cause harm but are not illegal. Until now, they were still officially recorded by police. But from today, that requirement has been scrapped. Instead, the Home Office says a new common sense-led approach will be introduced, meaning officers will only attend and record a hate incident if it might help prevent a crime or fulfil other key policing purposes, such as protecting life and property or maintaining public order. The change has been welcomed by the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. She said the new regulations would stop forces from policing perfectly legal tweets and would instead allow them to patrol streets, catch criminals and keep communities safe. The Conservatives say the move will make no difference to police when it came to time and resources.
A BBC investigation has heard from parents who believe the wrong sperm or egg donors were used during their IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. Clinics there have become popular among British people seeking fertility treatment abroad. The British Fertility Society says incidents like this should never happen and that this is an appalling situation for families to be in. Anna Collinson reports.
Clinics in northern Cyprus boast high success rates, low costs and a vast array of sperm and egg donors from around the world. But a BBC investigation has discovered that the parents of at least seven children believe that their fertility clinics use the wrong donor sperm or donor eggs in their IVF treatments. Most now have completed DNA tests, including one family who've had it confirmed that their two children are not biologically related. Experts say discovering new information about a donor can have a significant psychological impact on a donor-conceived person. Northern Cyprus, which is only legally recognised by Turkey, has its own laws, and unlike the UK, does not have an independent fertility regulator which monitors clinics. The territory's Ministry of Health has not responded to our findings.
You can hear the full story on Phylon 4 Investigates on BBC Sounds now or on Radio 4 at 8 o'clock tonight. Australia's internet regulator says some tech firms may not be doing enough to comply with the country's ban on under-16s using social media platforms. The law, the first of its kind in the world, came into force last December. Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok and YouTube are now facing an investigation, which could result in heavy fines. Meta, which owns Instagram as well as Facebook, says it's working constructively with the Australian government to implement the ban.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past seven. Why won't the doctors' union, the BMA, let their members vote on the government's latest pay offer? And will the Prime Minister's threat to withdraw the promise of an extra 1,000 training places for junior doctors make them think again before the next wave of strikes, which is due to hit the NHS in England from next Tuesday? Well, the man with the answers to those questions is the chair of the BMA committee, which represents what are now called officially resident doctors, Dr. Jack Fletcher. Morning to Dr. Fletcher, and thank you for coming in. What about that threat? The Prime Minister says he's going to withdraw the offer of 1,000 new training places. Is that a price you're willing to pay to get more money?
So we've been willing, and we have been talking constructively for the last 2 months. And then in the very last minute, the government has shifted the goalposts of the pay offer that they were discussing, that we were discussing collectively a few months ago. I am very, very happy and willing to sit down and talk constructively once again. We've made clear to the government what it would take to essentially get back to where we were, which was essentially let's go back to the bit before they started shifting the goalposts. And I think making threats about withholding jobs from doctors and essentially stopping doctors from caring for patients, I don't think is a realistic way or a credible way of ending this dispute. It will end in a negotiating room. I'm very happy to sit down with the government at any point to try and negotiate a settlement, but I don't think that's done by writing in newspapers and issuing threats unilaterally. I think that's done in a negotiating room in a constructive
way. Well, let's be clear, you're threatening him and you're threatening the country by having the 15th round of strikes. That is a threat against patients. It's a threat against taxpayers. It's a threat not just against ministers. But I ask you again, is it a gamble you're willing to take? He says he will withdraw that offer of 1,000 new training places. Are you willing to take that gamble?
So if the Prime Minister and the Health Secretary would like to withdraw those 1,000 jobs, then that is their prerogative. What we're saying is we think it's bad for patients, we think it's bad for doctors, and this comes at a time when you pick up the phone this morning and many listeners will pick up the phone and hear hold music as they try to access GP appointments. There are patients right now being treated in corridors in A&E, and yet we are turning tens of thousands of resident doctors away from training places in the NHS. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister and Health Secretary are threatening to cut those jobs further, which we don't think is a way to try and get to a settlement here.
This is a desperately frustrating for people who work in the NHS, for people who depend on the NHS. Couldn't you just solve this problem quite simply? Put the offer to your members. Will you do that?
So we discussed this with our committee, who are representatives of our members. They're directly elected from across the country, across England and across the rest of the UK, to represent our members who are resident doctors, who are working right now. We're working today, we're working across the weekend, and their representatives have considered this offer. We don't think it goes far enough on pay because of the way the government shifted the
goals. You will not put this offer to your members?
We've decided not to put this offer to our members.
Dr. Fletcher? Because there was a suggestion that you were in favour of putting it into the membership.
So I think we've been really clear, and I've been really clear to the Health Secretary in person last week that this does not represent a credible offer and it does not go far enough compared to where the progress...
Were you initially prepared to put this offer to your members?
Well, what we were talking about a few weeks ago was an offer on pay as well as jobs. And then right at the last minute, in the last 2 weeks, the government have shifted those goalposts.
Sure,
by
but forgive
reducing...
me, that wasn't my question. Were you initially willing to put this offer to your members?
If you give me a second just to explain. So 2 weeks ago, the government took that investment, reduced it, and then stretched it over 3 years. That is a very, very, very different outcome to the one that we were discussing just 2 weeks ago.
So you're saying you were willing to recommend the original deal. Is that right?
So I'm not saying that we were willing to recommend it. We were negotiating.
And you were willing to put it to your members, the original deal.
We continued to negotiate, and then the government shifted the goalposts right at the last minute.
Still not clear. It's a really simple question. I'm told that you were in favour of putting this to the members. Yes or no?
This deal, no.
No, but the previous one, yes, by implication. Now, this all comes down, as you've been clear, to an argument about pay. You say they've changed the goalposts, they've moved it over time. Just so we know where we stand, you don't dispute, do you, that in the last 3 years, because these are independently verified figures, between 23-4... financial year and 25-6, junior doctor or resident doctor's pay went up by 28.9% before inflation. But if you also include the fact that you can move up those pay scales quicker, one of the things you've been negotiating, it's significantly more than 30%.
So I think during the period, you know, let's talk about inflation for a second, because that erodes the real value of that. So between January 2022 and January 2026, inflation was around, between those two periods, around 28% by our maths. So actually, those numbers are inflated if you take them over a longer period, yes, but also you have to take inflation over that period. And we think since January 2022, which is essentially when this dispute was brewing.
Is there anyone else in the health services that's had 28.9% over the last 3 years? Is there anybody else you know in your life who has had 28.9% over the last 3 years?
So private sector earnings have kept up with inflation and have gone above it. We've also seen, I think it's important to recognise, the decade plus of real terms pay erosion.
No, my question was about last 3 years, isn't it? It's gone up by 28.9%. You accept that, but you say that inflation has been around about that level. It's gone up more if you accept the changes to the pay scales and the fact that junior doctors can move up them rather quicker. Are you seriously saying to the country that at a time of a global economic crisis in which there are warnings that Britain could face the sort of problems it faced in the 1970s, you're now going to put the country through yet more strikes to get yet more money?
So I think there's two parts to that question. I'll take them in turn. So the first one is, I don't think you can just say the last 3 years and look at those in isolation against the backdrop of a decade plus of pay erosion. That was consistent and regular erosion of the value of doctors' pay. And that was more significant than the vast majority of the public sector. So all we're asking for is a reversal of that. Nobody's asking for anything overnight. Nobody's asking for anything in one go. We're asking for a reversal of that. And on the second point around the current wider economic conditions, that is precisely the reason why this deal is not acceptable, because essentially what the government are recommending is potentially baking in real terms pay cuts, not just this year, but for future years, and we don't think that that's acceptable.
The strikes, you're clear, go on.
Absolutely not, and this is not just rhetoric. I am very happy and willing to talk to the government constructively, even today, to try and get a negotiated settlement, but I do not think that threats made publicly about cutting doctors' jobs achieves that, and I'm very willing to sit down and talk to the government even today.
Dr. Jack Fletcher, Chair of the BMA Committee, representing resident doctors. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. 16 minutes past seven, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said more than half of the country's war aims in Iran have been met. He believes as well that Iran's leadership will collapse internally. He was speaking to the US channel Newsmax.
I don't put a schedule on it. I think we've achieved a lot of things, a lot of things. We really degraded this regime, really hit them very hard. So it's definitely beyond the halfway point. But I don't want to put
halfway,
a schedule on
but
it.
But is it a problem that you think
but
is...
Beyond halfway in terms of missions, not necessarily in terms of time. I don't want to get into schedules.
Right.
Well, his country's parliament has also passed a law that would allow for Palestinians convicted of acts deemed to be terrorism to be executed. Let us talk about both of these things. Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's international editor, is on the line. First of all, what he's telling the Americans, and he was talking to a conservative news channel there, wasn't he, Jeremy? What he's telling the Americans about what Israel is doing, which is obviously very important for Donald Trump and politically.
Yes, and Newsmax is one of Netanyahu's favourites. He doesn't give many interviews, but he does give them to Newsmax. He essentially, his war aim is to try to prolong this as long as possible, because he believes very much deeply in his bones, and has for 40 years, he said so, that the biggest threat to Israel is Iran, and therefore this war is something that he has wanted to do for his entire political life, and now he's succeeding in doing it. He has said to Israelis, and they tend to believe him according to opinion polls, that this is basically a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really get rid of the Islamic Republic as a threat. If it results in the regime falling, so much the better, but he's not bothered about that necessarily. What he wants to do is to make sure it's not a threat to Israel at any point in the future. So, frankly, he's keen to hammer it as much as possible. But what he doesn't want to do, though, is, of course, is to be seen to be telling Trump what to do in a public place like a television interview, because of course there have been a lot of reports and indications that one of the greatest influences on Donald Trump when he was deciding to go to war was in fact Benjamin Netanyahu.
Does he, when he talks about Iran's leadership collapsing internally, does he not mind then when that happens? In other words, if you say, if he wants the war to carry on and is quite relaxed actually about the timing of it, in contradistinction perhaps to Donald Trump, then he's able to say, well, it will collapse, but not necessarily soon.
I think that the Israelis are relaxed about the prospect of internal chaos consuming Iran, because the argument is that if the Iranians are at each other's throats, well, they're not going to be at Israel's throats. But of course, that's something which the neighbours of Iran, including the Gulf states, who of course have been very much in the firing line, are very concerned about, because the thought of having a very large country with a population of 90 million breaking up in the way, in chaos, in the way that, say, Iraq was for many, many years, and that means that those problems do not stay within the borders. They often get exported in terms, not just in terms of refugees, but in terms of the activities of armed groups. As Iraq fell apart, those jihadist groups like ISIS were spawned as a result of all of that. So the thought of chaos horrifies other people, not least outside the Middle East as well. But yeah. I think that Netanyahu's belief is that actually Israel can defend itself. That is not the issue. The issue is whether or not Iran will one day have nuclear weapons or other kinds of ballistic weapons again, which might kill Jews and damage Israel.
Final point about Israel and this passing of a law that would allow for Palestinians convicted of terrorism to be executed. Why is that so controversial?
Well, it's controversial because the way that the law is framed, Israel has got the death penalty, though it's only carried it out, I think, twice in its history. And one of them is the Nazi war criminal Eichmann, who Israel kidnapped and put on trial many, many years ago. So the death penalty isn't regularly carried out, though, of course, critics of Israel say that they carry out many, many extrajudicial executions. Germany, UK, France, Italy, they're against this. They call it de facto discriminatory, undermining Israel's commitment to democracy. And human rights groups say that apartheid is actually what is behind all of this. It's discriminatory because the way the law is framed, it will not apply to Israeli Jews, 80% of the population, and it will be in military courts, and Israelis are not tried in military courts. So therefore, this is a law aimed squarely at Palestinians, so therefore discriminating on racial grounds.
Jeremy Byrne, our international editor. Thank you.
21 minutes past seven now. Time for the business news. The British company that makes credit card-sized computers, Raspberry Pi, it's had some good news at a time of difficult economic news more generally. Sean can tell us more.
Yeah, interesting. It's seen its sales and profits shoot up last year. It's based in Cambridge, of course. Seen demand for its semiconductor devices that have sent sales higher for those than their traditional ready-to-use computer boards for the first time. Overall, £26 million of profit before tax on sales of more than £320 million. Those sales up by a quarter. Founder and Chief Executive Eben Upton with us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What are your customers doing with your products that's driven this demand?
All sorts of things. I mean, the uses of Raspberry Pi are incredibly widespread, everything from, I guess, consumer electronics to industrial automation to aerospace. As you say, the big standout news this year is that we're selling more chips than we're selling boards. Now, in terms of revenue, the chips are substantially lower cost than the boards. So economically, that's not yet hugely significant for us, but we think it's a really nice sign that we're being able to diversify the business away from that traditional boards and modules.
What are people using these chips for? I know we talk about semiconductors nearly every day, the global growth of AI on a very, very big scale. What are your customers doing with them?
So these are what we call microcontrollers. These are relatively small, relatively low performance devices. And what they get used as is glue. We talk about glue logic. So they get used inside other larger products to connect subsystems of those products together.
Right. And you, also in your results, you talk about enthusiast customer bases as well. So is there a growth? Are you still seeing that growth of individuals using products in their homes? Is it for their little businesses?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think where we come from as Raspberry Pi, we had this founding desire to get young people involved in computing. So the enthusiasts, the educators have always been very important to us. It's a market for us that continues to grow, but it's been a market that over the years has been vastly outgrown by what we call industrial and embedded business.
And we haven't said AI just yet, but is that what this is all about?
A lot of our largest volume OEM customers, our largest volume embedded customers, are people who take our product and build it into their own products. Those are AI customers. Now, they tend to be, there's a lag in these things, right? So if you think 5 years ago, AI meant vision AI. It largely meant recognizing objects in images. And so we have a number of very large OEM customers who are using Raspberry Pi in industrial automation applications to do that.
Can I ask you just about supply chain at the moment? We talked at this time of the morning about helium and the crucial role it has in semiconductors and the problems it has in the Strait of Hormuz. Are you seeing any of that?
We're not seeing anything yet, obviously, particularly that sensitivity of semiconductor manufacture to helium availability. Now, helium is a byproduct of the natural gas industry. Some of the activity in the Middle East has disrupted helium supply. Nobody's telling us yet that they can't build chips, but it's something we're keeping a very close eye on.
Is it something you think may well materialize later in the year?
I don't think we know at this point. I think it's a little bit too early. Obviously, the manufacturers maintain substantial buffers of these chemicals.
Eben Upton, founder and chief executive of Raspberry Pi, thank you very much.
Sean, thank you. 7:25 is the time. The Scottish Government is once again in trouble over ferries. The ferries that run on the west coast of the nation are depended on, of course, by locals and tourists alike. Opposition parties calling it a fiasco, a scandal. The company Calmac saying four large ferries are broken, four are getting annual maintenance. Let us talk to Brian Curry, who's the owner of the Craigard Hotel on the island of Barra. Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What's the impact on you been?
Significant. Yesterday, for example, I had to bring an extra staff member in just to handle phone calls. For a small hotel at this time of the year, that's significant. I believe we took a dozen cancellations yesterday morning. Might not sound a lot in the grand scheme of things, but when you only have 9 rooms available, and I think 7 of these cancellations were for next Friday alone.
And is that because people simply can't get across or they don't want to take the risk?
And particularly on Friday, they simply couldn't get across. There was no direct sailings offered to our small island.
It's not new, this, is it? That this mishandling of the ferries. Is this particularly acute, or are you seeing this? Have you seen this now for years?
Well, we've definitely seen this for years, and Calmac are saying it's unprecedented. There is a degree, I think, of this being self-caused. You know, we live within a small community where there are many members of the crew who live in our communities, and they talk about the red pen going through things in dry dock, things that just aren't done. And we hear things that, you know, critical maintenance items aren't being uptaken. And I think it's just a compound fact, and it's all catching up and catching them out now.
Do people blame the government, the Scottish government?
Definitely more so, I believe, in this case than Calmac. Community members have challenged lots of operational decisions over the year. I think there is a light consensus that they're not entirely to blame for this. I think it's a lack of investment.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, what we're talking about is it is just not funded, in your view, to an extent that would allow it to function properly.
I think there's been plenty funding there. However, when you see the cost of the two ships that were built within Scotland, you know, we could have built 10 ships effectively for that. And the fact
why
that
is
they're
that?
Bringing... Well, they overspend in the build that were significant. The time, more than anything, people have been waiting 8 years for these ships. One of them now is in service and incidentally broken down as well.
Are you going to be able to stay in business, Mr. Curry?
If this went on for long periods of time, no. Nobody could sustain this. I'm just reading correspondence from another community member this morning. Some of our friends of mine within Barra Gin, who are facing significant costs. They're citing costs of up to £50,000 for a small business. That's not sustainable.
Brian Curry, owner of the Craigard Hotel on Barra. Thank you.
28 minutes past seven. It's Cathy with the sport.
Morning. Thank you very much. Spurs are hoping Roberto De Zerbi can save their season. They've entered into advanced talks with the former Brighton manager, who is now willing to take charge of the club immediately. It had been thought that his preference was to wait until the end of the season. One of England's World Cup group opponents, Ghana, has sacked their manager, Otto Addo, just 10 weeks before the tournament starts. Ghana have lost their last four friendly fixtures and didn't qualify for this year's Africa Cup of Nations. England face Japan tonight in their last friendly in this country before the World Cup starts. And Scotland play Ivory Coast later at the Hill Dickinson Stadium in Liverpool. We can speak to the former Scotland winger. Morning, Pat Nevin.
Good morning, Kathy.
Scotland's group at the World Cup is Brazil, Morocco, Haiti. How does that group perhaps have a bearing on why Scotland and Steve Clarke chose Ivory Coast as opponents, one of their last opponents tonight?
Well, the next opponents will be Curaçao. Well, they're in the same confederation as Haiti. So that makes sense, but Côte d'Ivoire, they're the same as Morocco, the same African Confederation. And of course, they'll not play exactly the same way, but it gives Scotland players and the Scotland manager an idea of how they will play. And it should help a little bit of that standard of opposition. So that's the kind of reasoning behind it. That's what the managers usually say.
Yes, yes, I understand that. And 1998 was the last time, as you well know, Scotland were at a World Cup almost 30 years ago. There was great excitement when they qualified. But in their first game since then, they were booed for losing 1-0 to Japan on Saturday. Were you surprised by that reaction?
Slightly surprised. I think it was unfair. Scotland didn't play badly against Japan. They just didn't play brilliantly. And the fact that they've qualified for three tournaments out of four, obviously two of those being Euros, I think that's a little bit harsh. And the players have done a pretty good job, and particularly the manager as well. However, the fans have paid the money, so they're allowed to do whatever they like. And I think the problem isn't the fans. It certainly isn't the players, because they need to protect themselves to some degree because of possible injuries. And it's just basically the fact that friendlies are a bit silly in international football these days, because, you know, what you get out of them positively is not good. But I'm not going to have a dig at the SFA either, because they're doing it for money. So call me an old anti-disestablishmentarianismist if you like. But yeah, I know why the SFA do it.
Yes, I mean, I suppose you also need to practice before you go to a World Cup as well. We saw that recently with the England test.
Have a look at what England fans are doing. They're throwing airplanes onto the ground. So it's a bit boring for the fans, you know, paying a lot of money and maybe not getting the standard of football that they expect. And I understand that argument.
And a changeable team. We're going to see a raft of changes, according to Steve Clarke, from the team that played Japan in this game tonight. How close do you think he is? And this is another reason why we have these friends, isn't it? So that he gets an idea of who he wants to play. Or do you think he already knows who he wants to take in his World Cup squad?
He'll be just about totally sure exactly who he'll take. Because it doesn't change that much. We've not got a huge pool. It's not like Thomas Tuchel in England, who's probably got three or four decisions to make in every single position about who he shall or shall not bring. Not the case with Scotland. It's just at the edges. One or two players maybe be able to scratch their way onto that plane and just have a look at them tonight. The players that are trying hardest, that's the ones it will be.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that, Pat Nevin. Thank you very much. Just to mention one other match, this fixture between Wales and Northern Ireland. They face each other in a friendly tonight in Cardiff after both sides missed out on a World Cup qualifying position, losing their playoff semi-finals.
Thank you, Cathy, for that.
We must start at the beginning.
On BBC iPlayer,
To be poor and handsome is misfortune enough, but to be penniless and plain is a hard fate indeed.
Starring Ruth Jones and Richard E. Grant.
You shall all go to the ball, as long as I'm obliged to hear no more about it.
Four good marriages will have to do.
I only hope she does not ruin her sister's chances.
The other Bennet sister.
Is it possible you'll ever find a way to fit in?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Let's take a quick look at the weather. Today, a mainly cloudy start with patchy light rain in places. Occasional bright spells elsewhere in the afternoon.
28 minutes to 8 is the time. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. Nick Robinson, Justin Webb and Caroline Nichols with the news.
It's emerged that the Metropolitan Police questioned Scott Mills in 2016 in relation to allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. The BBC sacked the Radio 2 presenter yesterday following allegations about his personal conduct, but did not give any further details. In a statement this morning, the Met said the alleged offences were reported to have taken place between 1997 and 2000. A file was then submitted to the Crown Prosecution Service, which determined there was not enough evidence to bring charges and the investigation was closed. Sir Keir Starmer has told resident doctors in England 48 hours to call off their planned strike or lose 1,000 extra training places. The six-day walkout, which is due to start next Tuesday, is part of a dispute over pay and jobs. The expansion of training posts has been a key part of negotiations between the government and the doctors' union, the British Medical Association. The BMA told this programme issuing public threats wasn't a constructive way forward. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that US-Israeli attacks are weakening Iran's leadership and that more than half of his military aims in the country have been achieved. Mr. Netanyahu was speaking on US television after President Trump said he would obliterate Iranian infrastructure. Four Israeli soldiers have been killed during fighting against the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Two others have been wounded. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting following the deaths of three peacekeepers in Lebanon in the past 2 days. Israel says it's investigating what happened. Parents have told the BBC that they believe IVF facilities in northern Cyprus used the wrong sperm or egg donors in their treatments. British people looking for fertility treatments are increasingly turning to services in the territory. The British Fertility Society described the families' situations as appalling.
Thank you for that. 25 to 8 is the time. What does Donald Trump want to achieve in his war with Iran? The question hangs over the whole enterprise, of course, but is particularly acute this morning, with the president on the one hand threatening huge destruction in Iran as a next step, but also, according to the Wall Street Journal overnight, telling his aides he might end the war and leave the Strait of Hormuz, so crucial to the world economy, effectively closed if that is what Iran chose to do. Kirsten Fontenrose was senior director for the Gulf at the National Security Council in the first Trump administration. She told me what she made of the Wall Street Journal report.
A couple of things from that report. One, remember, he's underscoring his position that this is really something the partner nations should be helping with because they are more reliant on energy coming through the strait than the U.S. is. So opening the strait is not really one of the stated U.S. military objectives for the strikes on Iran to begin with. And with only about 2.4% of the petroleum products the U.S. uses coming through there, you know, this is something that the partners need to pitch in with. We can claim victory on our military objectives, he thinks, in the U.S. without necessarily reopening the straits. I think he's also using Secretary of State Rubio to deliver the message that they hope to still have a deal that would encompass opening the straits. If you look at, there are two articles in the Convention on the Law of Seas within the UN, I think it's 26 and 44, and they say that any freedom of navigation lanes, any shipping lanes that are specifically for global navigation cannot be closed or taxed by any single nation. So you're hearing Rubio say, we absolutely do not agree with Iran saying they own the strait or can put tolls on the strait, but we would love for the opening of the strait to be part of a deal.
Well, what would that deal then be? What would it have to incorporate?
It would have to incorporate some of the demands the U.S. has made from the beginning. There's just no way around it. Things like Iran agreeing not to enrich uranium, not to develop advanced missiles, not to fund proxies. And the exchange would be things like sanctions relief and foreign direct investment coming into Iran. So this administration in the U.S. really is still looking for that deal. But the Washington and Tehran are talking past each other. They're making those demands and Iran is making entirely different demands, things like war reparations.
Do you think then that there are or are not meaningful talks taking place, or indeed the prospect of those talks in the immediate future?
The prospect is there. The talks are rather indirect. We know that they are through intelligence channels because that is where Pakistan and Egypt have their relationships inside Iran. It's sort of respect for each other's mutual intelligence structures, and they have relationships they can draw on. So when we talk about talks taking place, we say, who in Iran can even do this? Who has the authority in Iran to even show up on Iran's side? By the Constitution, without the supreme leader in place, you know, publicly, it should be the president. But we're watching the IRGC really still call those shots. So there is a possibility, but right now the two sides are asking for entirely different things. And since both think that they're in a strong position, neither seems willing to concede.
Does Donald Trump, do you think, have the strategic patience to see this out?
It depends on what you mean by see it out. Right now, the U.S. says we've got war plans up through April 6th, and we're frankly ahead of schedule. So when they say that, the president probably does have the will to see that out. He can also resist international pressure on the Straits simply because it's slower to impact the U.S. economy, since the U.S. is less reliant on that strait. But he's got midterm elections coming up. He doesn't have to get reelected, but his party does. And if you see the prices spike in the oil that the U.S. does consume for manufacturing and for travel at a peak time, when those times come around, if this is still going on, you would see domestic pressure. But right now, he's under less domestic pressure than many European and Asian governments are. So he's looking likely to see through, at least through the end of the several weeks of campaigning that the military asked for at the very beginning.
Kirsten Fontenrose, thank you very much. Iran, meanwhile, is talking aggressively about its own ability to defend itself and indeed to do things after the end of the war that might affect those who supported it. For instance, a plan to impose tolls on traffic in the Strait of Hormuz and ban some nations, including the US, which has been put before the Iranian authorities and appears to have been approved. What then do they make of American threats of escalation? I've been talking to Professor Sasan Karimi, who is a former deputy vice president of Iran, and I asked him specifically what would happen if the U.S. decided to seize Karg Island.
For the United States soldiers, it will be not free for the regional actors, for the regional partners of the United States. Our friends will be damaged in their energy. Nobody will be able to export a single tier of oil from tomorrow morning. I'm totally sure about it. And the reaction of Iran will be not possible to even calculate. I think that this will be the biggest mistake of the United States, to put the boots on the ground of Iran and want to stop exporting oil, etc. Because you see about Hormuz that when they attempted something, Iran reacted more than professionally, more than strongly, and not the United States, with all its neighbor, all its friends and allies, neither of them could open the Strait of Hormuz. And the retaliatory measures, the remedial measures of Iran for its energy and for its soil will be totally not proportionate, I want to say. The consequences will be quite high that everybody will be totally sorry for.
How do you believe the war ends?
I think the United States should stop its attack and declare that I stop unilaterally the attacks and stop Israeli regime to continue the attacks from this moment. And then they should give us two things: the guarantee for not repeating any further attack, and to compensate all the casualties and the materialistic expenses that we paid. It is over $100 billion that they should pay. We are not responsible for their ambitions to occupy Iran, to change the regime of Iran and all the
And in return for that,
failures.
Though, in return for that, what would Iran give? Would it, for instance, say we will not pursue nuclear weapons?
Iran is not the one who should pay anything because they attacked Iran and it is not due to international law, due to legal terms, due to logical terms. It is not wise that somebody attack you and claim for something and get half of this after a totally failure attempt in military section. So it is not possible. Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapon. It is over two decades under severe monitoring that everybody knows that if Iran wanted to build it up, it would have been built up until now. But Iran does not want to pursue the nuclear weapon, but it will definitely will pursue its nuclear program and enrichment, which is not related to weapon necessarily. The solution is monitoring that was being handled over two decades. It is possible to negotiate about it. Iran's conventional military potentials and assets like missiles, etc., which is not abandoned by international law, is not something to negotiate about. It is not possible that you attack someone and then they pay half of this. And Iran is only committed to the international law, not to the ambitions of Donald Trump.
Professor Sassan Karimi, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
It is 17 minutes to 8. If you're tempted to turn over to Radio 2 this morning to hear Scott Mills present The Breakfast Show, don't. He's been sacked, but so far his BBC bosses have said very little about why. Let's see if our media editor, Katie Razzle, can help us with that. Morning to you, Katie. It's The Mirror which has revealed more details about a previous investigation into Scott Mills, isn't it?
Yes, you're absolutely right, Nick. The Mirror is reporting allegations that 10 years ago, Scott Mills was questioned under caution by police in relation to serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. The case was dropped due to a lack of evidence and no further action was taken. Now, we do have a statement from a police spokesperson and they have told us in December 2016, the Met began an investigation following a referral from another police force. The investigation related to allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. These were reported to have taken place between 1997 and 2000. As part of these inquiries, a man who was in his 40s at the time of the interview was questioned by police under caution in July 2018. A full file of evidence was submitted to the Crown Prosecution Service, who determined the evidential threshold had not been met to bring charges. Following this advice, the investigation was closed in May 2019.
What is striking about this case is not just that the BBC management are saying very little about it, but the speed here. Mills being shown the door before most people learn there are any allegations against him at all.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, he's been off air since last week. His last show was on Tuesday and he clearly thought he was coming back the next day, as he said, see you tomorrow at the end. But he didn't return. And only yesterday we found out that he was permanently out. And I do understand colleagues assumed illness or family bereavement. So even some of those closest to him on the show only realised what had happened yesterday when the news broke. You're right. This was first reported in the Mail that he'd been sacked. The Mirror, that he'd been sacked over his personal conduct. But the BBC did not give those details. So we first got an email from the director of music, Lorna Clark, talking about the shock and, you know, saying she wanted to personally let us know that Scott News had left The Breakfast Show. And all the BBC officially has said is, while we do not comment on matters relating to individuals, we can confirm Scott Mills is no longer contracted to work with the BBC.
Is it possible that this is the outgoing director general, Tim Davey, who's in his last few days in the job, clearing the decks? After all, he said, Samir Shah, the chair of the BBC, said after the Hugh Edwards case, this has to change, the culture has to change, the rules in effect have to change.
Well, there are theories going around. I think we can say it's ironic that it's taking place when Tim Davey's still in charge in his last week. But I do know he was across all the developments. But I rather think he might have hoped it could wait for just a few days, because, of course, his tenure at the BBC has seen several high-profile cases of presenters forced out because, as Tim Davey would put it, their behaviour doesn't live up to BBC values. I do think an organisation shouldn't necessarily be judged on the behaviour of individuals who work for it, but it should be judged on whether its culture enables inappropriate behaviour and how it responds when the behaviour is raised. And we don't know, of course, what the situation is in relation to Scott Mills, and haven't so far been able to contact him. But you're right. After the Hugh Edwards crisis, the BBC launched a review of its culture, professing its intention to stamp out bad behaviour. And Tim Davey told the Culture, Media and Sport Committee at the time, no one is irreplaceable. So you could, you're right, Nick, see this as, you know, Davey's last stand, if you like, because the message is nobody is too big to be fired if their behaviour has compromised the BBC. And I'm sure that is the message that Tim Davey, in his last week, might like us to take away.
Katie Russell, our media editor, thank you.
8:30. In a few minutes' time, we'll hear from Dr. Nikki Fox at NASA, who's going to be looking forward to tomorrow's Artemis trip to the moon, the furthest into space, of course, that man has ever been. But first, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, the vicar of St. Martin in the Fields, who is here in the studio. Morning to you, sir.
Good morning. The US Defence Secretary has a habit of pausing for a moment of prayer. Last week, he prayed that there be overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. Some days later, the Pope offered a rather different perspective. He said God doesn't listen to those who wage war. Prayer is having a moment. On Sunday, there was a furore in Jerusalem when police prevented the Latin Patriarch from presiding at Palm Sunday Mass at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Just lately, a Muslim iftar breaking the Ramadan fast across the road from where I live on Trafalgar Square attracted debate about whether mass public prayer could be described as an act of domination. Leaving aside the more general issues about freedom of expression and the separation of church and state, these episodes highlight the overlap between often fervid politics and supposedly ethereal prayer. Those who call prayer a political act are right, in the sense that to pray is to acknowledge an authority higher than any worldly power. Anyone who thinks they're the greatest is likely to find that gesture threatening. Unsettling the authority structures of his time is, after all, what got Jesus in trouble 2,000 years ago this week. The expression private prayer is actually an oxymoron. When you acknowledge a power greater than any other, you're not just saying that for yourself, you're making a claim about everyone and everything. But prayer can never be just a political act. If you genuinely hold that higher power to be indescribably more significant than anything else, you shouldn't really be in the business of performative prayer. Jesus said, "Beware of practicing your piety before others in order to be seen by them, for then you have no reward from your Father in heaven." It's like a conversation at a drinks reception. If your conversation partner thinks you're looking over their shoulder and are more interested in how you look to someone else, why should they pay attention to you? I think of the person praying as occupying the aperture of an hourglass between heaven above and earth below. In prayer, you start by seeing God from the world's point of view, and ideally end by seeing the world from God's point of view. Prayer is about the world and me becoming more like God, not about God and the world becoming more like me. I take the view that almost everyone prays. That's because prayer is the moment we weigh what's eternally important against what seems currently urgent. The thing about public prayer is everyone gets to see what you think is eternally important. It may not bear their scrutiny.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells. Brings us to 10 to 8.
The countdown is underway for the launch of Artemis 2.
Something big is getting ready to happen. I am thrilled to say that our countdown clock picked up just a little bit ago and began counting at 4:44. And we are just about 2 days away from our targeted launch date.
That was the launch director, Charlie Blackwell Thompson of NASA. Artemis 2's crew of four astronauts will boldly go where no man has gone before, literally traversing the far side of the moon and going further, reaching up to 250,000 miles from Earth, about 1,500 miles further than the Apollo 13 astronauts. Their job is to prepare the way for future missions, which will involve landing on the moon again and then creating a base to exploit its natural resources and act as a transit stop on the way to Mars. Scientists at NASA are, of course, eagerly awaiting the flight, not least today's former guest editor, Dr. Nikki Fox of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA, whose love of space, you may remember if you heard her programme, began when she was a toddler and her father told her about those Apollo missions. I caught up with her yesterday and asked her what made this trip to the moon different.
This isn't just about sort of, you know, a landing, picking up some samples and coming back with the Apollo program. This is really about building a sustained presence at the moon. And so Artemis 2 is that first mission. It is the first steps to us being able to actually have a moon base at the South Pole of the moon and have that sustained presence, which opens up so many opportunities for science. And we're very excited.
Now, Artemis 2 doesn't land on the moon. That's the next mission, Artemis 3. Is the reason for that that this is, in effect, a scientific recce? Is it checking the landscape, working out where the next mission goes?
There's many things that we're doing, but yes, absolutely, checking out all of the systems. It's the first time that we've had astronauts in deep space in the lunar environment. So actually being able to measure the radiation and the effect of microgravity on a human. Artemis 3 actually will go to low Earth orbit. Our administrator announced they're going to do a full test in low Earth orbit of actually docking with the landers and also check out the suits that the astronauts will be wearing. And then Artemis 4 will go down to the lunar surface in 2028. They're actually hoping for Artemis 5 to also launch in 2028.
And Artemis 2 isn't just about preparations for all that follows. It's also got some exciting science, which is where you come in. What is it that's exciting you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's all science all the time. You know, you send an astronaut, they take a look at something, they tell you what you've seen. That's science. And so we are embracing that completely. We have a full real-time campaign where we have our scientists. They will be located at Johnson Space Center, where we are doing all the communications with the crew. We have a science officer actually in mission control, which is really exciting. And so they have trained the crew. They've trained them sort of in geology. They've looked at maps of what they're going to see on the lunar surface, and they will actually be taking pictures. They'll be talking in real time. And so for me, sitting in that science evaluation room with the team and being able to interact with the crew as they are looking at the far side of the moon for the first time in over 50 years. And so it's really spectacular.
Now, science is often collaborative. Everybody benefits from a discovery. But you were very open when you were our guest editor a little while back that we are, in your words, in a space race against China. Why should listeners care who wins that space race? What's at stake?
It's predominance at the moon. You know, we will land there first. We will set up a moon base and we will have a peaceful presence on the moon. You know, one of the things we talk about with Artemis is it isn't just about one country going to the moon as it was in Apollo. You know, we have the Artemis Accords. We have more than 50 countries that have signed on to be part of the Artemis mission. And we have all kinds of opportunities for our international partners to come along with us, whether they are contributing science instruments, whether they are contributing a pressurized rover, whether they are contributing, you know, a habitat. There are all kinds of different ways for our international partners to be involved. And so this is really about the whole world having a peaceful presence on the lunar surface.
And with benefits down on Earth, but also potentially for the next step, which is heading to Mars.
Oh, and you know, I'm all about that. I think of the moon kind of as a training ground for going to Mars. That journey to Mars is very long. It is not a quick journey. It takes at least 6 months to get to Mars. And then landing on Mars, you know, the moon is not very hospitable, neither is Mars. And so, you know, having to be ready to operate the moment you get to Mars. But yes, thinking about all of the things that we will have to do, all the risks we need to retire, ensuring that we have exactly the right kit for those astronauts, because every little gram is really counts in these missions. And so you don't want to take anything that you don't need.
There's a bit of you, I know, last time we spoke, is still the little girl, Mickey, whose father showed her those early lunar missions. Have you got that excitement this week that you had all those years ago?
I had it. Actually, I sat at the flight readiness review a couple of weeks ago, and my boss, Amit Kshatriya, actually asked us to sort of take a moment and sort of fill our hearts with love and think about the people that have got us to where we are and, you know, the people that support us, because this is a very big undertaking that we're doing. And the first thing I thought about was, you know, 2 years old, my dad pointing up at the moon and saying, there are people up there. And, you know, I just thought, well, if my dad knew that that 2 year old was literally about to say NASA science is go for the moon, you know, what that would have meant to him. So I actually got very, very emotional, very choked up, very teary in the moment. So I did text my mom and say, I really miss my dad right now. And she said, oh, he's looking down and very proud of you.
And you have to hope, I imagine, that someone somewhere is saying to another little girl, look up at Artemis, watch that launch. And maybe they follow you in a few decades' time.
Oh, I really hope so. I'm always talking about the fact that, you know, the children of today, particularly, you know, the young children in primary school, are the age of the astronauts that will go to Mars. And so that's so exciting that, you know, we can inspire this whole new generation.
Dr. Nikki Fox of NASA, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Go Artemis.
Just to say, tomorrow morning, there is a new series of personal stories coming to Radio 4.
Some events have far-reaching consequences.
The white noise, everything goes black, and apparently I was screaming. That's the moment that my life changed forever.
I'm Dr. Sian Williams, and I'm meeting the people whose lives have been reshaped in unexpected ways.
That broke my heart. I just thought that is so cruel.
Personal stories of loss, discovery, and starting over.
We do talk about it time to time and about how grateful we are to be in this country, to be able to be free.
The new series of Life Changing, tomorrow morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Time for the weather now. Here's Stav.
Thanks very much, Nick and Justin. Good morning to you. High pressure building in today and tomorrow. That'll bring a lot of dry and settled weather. You could call that quiet before the storm, because towards the end of the week, an active jet will fire up and that'll bring areas of low pressure to our shores. And there is a chance of some gales, even severe gales, to northern and western parts of the UK into the Easter weekend. But there's still uncertainty on this, so you have to stay tuned to the forecast. Today, though, it is a mostly cloudy day. High pressure's establishing itself across the UK, bringing lighter winds, west to southwesterly winds, and a lot of cloud, with the thickest cloud for western Scotland, Northern Ireland, western England, northern and western Wales, where we'll see some patchy drizzle at times. But into the afternoon, we'll see some cloud breaks developing, some sunny spells, particularly to the lee of high ground, northeast Scotland, eastern England, and perhaps northeastern parts of Wales. And where we get the sunshine with this milder air, then we could be hitting the 16 or 17 Celsius mark. But for many today, 11 to 15 degrees. We are a few degrees up on where we should be. Tomorrow, similar story for England and Wales, but it'll start to turn wetter, windier and colder across Scotland and Northern Ireland, with increasing snow on the hills. As we head in towards the end of the week, it turns more unsettled.
Stav, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday the 31st of March. The headlines this morning: it's emerged that Scott Mills, the BBC Radio 2 presenter sacked by the corporation, was questioned over allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy in 2018, but the case was later closed. The Doctors' Union, the BMA, has said threats from Sir Keir Starmer aren't a credible way of averting next week's strike in England. And Israel's Prime Minister has said the war with Iran has achieved more than half its aims, but hasn't given a timeline for ending the conflict.
I don't put a schedule on it. I think we've achieved a lot of things, a lot of things. We really degraded this regime, really hit them very hard. So it's definitely beyond the halfway point.
We'll ask the second in command at the Treasury what the government can do to protect people from the economic effects of the war. At coming up after the bulletin.
And also coming up in the next hour, in the immortal words of Winnie the Pooh, you can never tell with bees, but you can listen in just before nine to hear about the new documentary showing a side of the insect you may not have seen before.
The bees vibrate their wings together to generate extreme heat. The temperature in the center reaches 115 degrees, hot enough to fry a hornet.
BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
It's emerged that the former BBC Radio 2 presenter Scott Mills was interviewed under caution in July 2018 about allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. In a statement, the Metropolitan Police said the Crown Prosecution Service decided the evidence threshold was not met and the investigation was closed in 2019. Scott Mills was sacked by the BBC yesterday. Our culture editor Katie Razzle reports.
The Mirror is reporting allegations that 10 years ago, Scott Mills, until last week presenter of the biggest breakfast show in the UK, was questioned under caution by police in relation to serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. The case was dropped due to a lack of evidence and no further action was taken. In a statement, a Metropolitan Police spokesperson told the BBC, in December 2016, the Met began an investigation following a referral from another police force. The investigation related to allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy. These were reported to have taken place between 1997 and 2000. As part of these inquiries, a man who was in his 40s at the time of the interview was questioned by police under caution in July 2018. A full file of evidence was submitted to the Crown Prosecution Service, who determined the evidential threshold had not been met to bring charges. Following this advice, the investigation was closed in May 2019.
The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, has been given 48 hours by the Prime Minister to call off the planned six-day strike in England or risk losing 1,000 extra training places. The industrial action is due to begin in a week's time, the 15th walkout in a long-running dispute over pay and jobs. The expansion of training posts has been a key part of negotiations between the government and the BMA. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Exchanges between the doctors' union and ministers have tended to get more acrimonious as a strike gets nearer, and the Prime Minister has intervened before to criticise the BMA for staging walkouts. This time there's a threat to ditch part of a proposed pay deal if the strike isn't called off. Writing in The Times, Sir Keir Starmer has criticised the union's decision to reject an offer as reckless, made worse by failing to put it to members, as well as an average 4.9% pay increase, including changes to pay scales. The government promised to create extra training places for doctors to advance their careers. Implementation of 1,000 of these was due to start in April, but the Prime Minister says this won't happen if the strike takes place next week.
The chair of the BMA's Resident Doctors Committee, Jack Fletcher, told us any differences would be resolved through negotiations.
We've made clear to the government what it would take to essentially get back to where we were, which was essentially let's go back to the bit before they started shifting the goalposts. And I think making threats about withholding jobs from doctors and essentially stopping doctors from caring for patients, I don't think is a realistic way or a credible way of ending this dispute.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the war against Iran has achieved more than half of his military aims. He also said the attacks by his country's forces and the US were weakening Iran's leadership. The Israeli military says its latest wave of airstrikes have targeted regime infrastructure in Tehran. Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
With energy prices soaring, the question of when the Iran war will end is a pressing one. But speaking to the US channel Newsmax, Benjamin Netanyahu declined to give a timeline for achieving Israel's war goals. After 1 month, he said the war was definitely beyond the halfway point, but later clarified he meant in terms of missions, not time. The Israeli Prime Minister said the war had killed thousands of members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards, and that his country and the US were close to finishing the arms industry, wiping out entire plants and the nuclear program itself. The Israeli leader again said that regime change was not the goal, but he voiced confidence that the Islamic Republic would collapse internally.
Four Israeli soldiers have been killed during fighting against the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Two others have been wounded. The UN Security Council is to hold an emergency meeting following the deaths of three peacekeepers in Lebanon in the past 2 days. Israel says it's investigating what happened. Kuwait says one of its oil tankers was directly targeted by an Iranian drone while in Dubai. None of the crew was hurt. The fire on board is now out. Our correspondent, Lorna Gordon, reports from Dubai.
The tanker Al Salmi, which the Reuters news agency reported had been en route to China, had been at anchor in Dubai when it was attacked. It was fully loaded with 2 million barrels of oil from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The vessel was hit by a drone just after midnight, setting it on fire and damaging its hull. There were initially concerns about a possible oil spill. Overnight missile and drone attacks and defensive interceptions were also reported in Sharjah in the UAE, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Reports from Iran, meanwhile, say that an Iranian parliamentary committee has approved plans to impose a toll on shipping, hoping to use the Strait of Hormuz. Around a fifth of the world's crude oil normally passes through the narrow stretch of water in the Gulf.
Police in England and Wales will no longer record most non-crime hate incidents. The College of Policing, which provides guidance to forces, says a fundamentally different approach will make clear that lawful free speech isn't a police matter. More details from Sam Harrison.
Non-crime hate incidents include single events such as arguments or abuse on social media, which cause harm but are not illegal. Until now, they were still officially recorded by police. But from today, that requirement has been scrapped. Instead, the Home Office says a new common sense-led approach will be introduced, meaning officers will only attend and record a hate incident if it might help prevent a crime or fulfil other key policing purposes, such as protecting life and property or maintaining public order. The change has been welcomed by the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. She said the new regulations would stop forces from policing perfectly legal tweets and would instead allow them to patrol streets, catch criminals and keep communities safe. The Conservatives say the move will make no difference to police when it came to time and resources.
A BBC investigation has heard from parents who believe the wrong sperm or egg donors were used during their IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. Clinics there have become popular among British people seeking fertility treatment abroad. The British Fertility Society says incidents like this should never happen and that this is an appalling situation for families to be in. Anna Collinson reports.
Clinics in northern Cyprus boast high success rates, low costs and a vast array of sperm and egg donors from around the world. But a BBC investigation has discovered that the parents of at least seven children believe that their fertility clinics use the wrong donor sperm or donor eggs in their IVF treatments. Most now have completed DNA tests, including one family who've had it confirmed that their two children are not biologically related. Experts say discovering new information about a donor can have a significant psychological impact on a donor-conceived person. Northern Cyprus, which is only legally recognised by Turkey, has its own laws, and unlike the UK, does not have an independent fertility regulator which monitors clinics. The territory's Ministry of Health has not responded to our findings.
Beth and Laura had two children via a sperm donation process in northern Cyprus, but DNA tests showed they were not biologically related. They told this programme about the effect on them.
For both of them, they're quite angry and confused about what's happened. For them, it's an important part of their identity because it's half of their genetics.
We're very much a family unit and we love each other and that won't change. But for the children, in that sense of who they are and who we thought they were, with knowing the donor that we chose and the information we had available, it's been quite an impact for them.
You can hear the full story on File on 4 Investigates on BBC Sounds Now or on Radio 4 at 8 o'clock tonight. A deal between the UK and France designed to reduce migrant crossings in the Channel is due to expire at midnight, with as yet no agreement on renewing it. The current scheme has been in place for the past 3 years and sees Britain pay the French authorities to carry out beach patrols in northern France. It's understood negotiations are ongoing and in the meantime operational cover will continue.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. Energy shocks affect everyone and everything. They cause shortages, not just of fuel, but of everything that needs fuel, including food products reliant on fertiliser. They cause inflation as supply is restricted. They cause governments to borrow more and pay more for debt as a result. And we're being warned that the energy shock underway now as a result of the war is bad, very bad, perhaps even the worst in modern history. What does the government plan to do to address it. The Prime Minister holds a meeting of the COBRA Emergency Committee today amid reports not only that the war is likely to last for weeks longer, but also that Donald Trump is telling aides he might end it without the Strait of Hormuz, that vital shipping lane, being reopened to the world's ships because it is not vital to US interests. Over the weekend, the Education Secretary was giving interviews saying people should be reassured to carry on as things are. Is that wise? Other nations are acting, particularly to cut taxes on fuel. Here, the government remains committed to raising petrol duty in September, although nobody really thinks that can happen. In a moment, a Treasury minister will set out the government's plans to allow households and businesses to survive in this new world. But first, Ruth Curtis is chief executive of the low-income-focused think tank, the Resolution Foundation.
So the most immediate impact that consumers probably will have noticed is the price of petrol rising at the pump now to over 150p. Those rises that we've seen in oil prices feed through to petrol very quickly. Although zooming out, petrol at least started this crisis relatively cheap compared to where it usually is. Another big pressure that will come is in energy bills. So this April, energy bills will fall, largely thanks to action taken by the government, and those prices are protected until June. But some customers from July and onwards will see prices in energy bills rise, and those will be particularly concerning when we hit the winter. And then finally, we would expect that this increase in energy costs and some of the wider disruption that we've seen could feed through to food prices. The government and Keir Starmer are talking in particular about the action they've already taken, and that will reduce energy bills this April. So they've moved certain charges from bills into funding from wider government tax revenues, and that will see typical bills reduced by £120, £130 in April. But we have now seen the war continue for some time, and so it does seem, for example, much more likely than not that that £130 reduction that we're about to see will be reversed in July. It's very difficult for a government to completely alleviate the effects of what is a big shock to the world, which really makes all of us poorer. But equally, I think if there are big rises in energy bills to come, and we don't yet know if there are, then the government might need to go further in terms of providing targeted support to some households. For example, one thing the government could do that would be short of the probably unaffordable universal support provided in 2022 would be some sort of targeted discount on energy bills for low-income households.
Right, that was Ruth Curtis on what things she thinks the government might want to consider. Other economists are focusing not on help from the government, but as it were, on our collective hair shirts. In the 70s, we dealt with petrol price rises by reducing consumption. There were reduced speed limits, for instance. More recently, for instance, during COVID, governments have tried to shield us from the pain. The economist Tim Lunig told PM last night that that just puts things off. We need, he said, to face facts.
Britain is poorer, and the only question is who pays the extra. And the extra is about £20 billion. It's £500, £600 a household. And what the Tories did, whatever it is now 5 years ago, is they decided to put that on the never, never of the credit card. And that means we pay later. Indeed, ironically, we're paying under a Labour government and Rachel Reeves is getting it in the neck for tax rises that are really to pay for profligate spending earlier. And I think we've worked out we can't do that anymore. And as you say, the alternative is we use less fuel. We can use it more efficiently. We can not fill our kettles. We can buy more energy efficient light bulbs. We can turn the heating down. There are things we can do and we should do them. We can do them as individuals. Government can help by signposting them.
That was the economist Tim Lunid. Let us talk now to James Murray, the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, who is listening to that. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Do you think it is a time now for the government to say clearly to people it is a time for at least personal rationing?
No, I think people should go about their lives as normal, knowing that the government is taking action to bring energy bills down. You know, I think a lot of people will be seeing the news from the Middle East and will see the instability and the uncertainty and might be worried about what's going to happen to energy bills in the months ahead. But they can know that from tomorrow, because of the energy price cap, bills will come down rather than going up.
But they also know they're going to go up longer term.
But people will know that whatever happens over the next 3 months in the Middle East, energy bills will be lower here.
No, not after July.
So that gives us time to make contingency plans for what happens further down the line.
Well, like,
the Prime
like
Minister,
what?
Well, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor are, you know, working through contingency plans so that we're prepared for the future. And in the longer run, Justin, over time, the focus that we've got on new nuclear power, new wind power, solar power, all of that is really important to giving us more energy independence in the future.
Isn't it a bit patronising to say to people, no, carry on, don't worry, we'll sort all of this out? They can see perfectly well, can't they, that this is a real proper crisis and there will have to be things done that are painful. It will make us poorer. And it's reasonable, isn't it, for them to ask you to be straight with them about it?
Well, I think we're being straight in saying that we honestly don't know how long this conflict is going to go on. You know, none of us know how long this is going to go on. We know there's instability and uncertainty, but what we can do is provide as much stability and resilience here at home, and that's what we're focused on.
Are you saying that it is possible then, if for some reason it ends tomorrow, which doesn't seem at all likely, but if it does end tomorrow in a week or two's time, that we just go back to normal?
Well, I think it's clear that what's happening in the Middle East now will have an impact on our economy. It's already having an impact on prices of energy and fuel, you know, when people fill up petrol stations. But what we can do is to shield people from those prices on their energy bills through the energy price cap that I've talked about, and also by making contingency plans for the future.
Are you saying it is likely then that energy bills don't rise after July?
Look, I'm not going to get ahead of ourselves, because we know that actually in the summer months, people tend to use less energy anyway. But what I know for sure is the work that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor are doing to make contingency plans for the future and to keep a very close eye on the numbers and what is happening. I think that what people will understand is the degree of uncertainty, is the fact that we don't know how long this is going to last, is the fact that we don't know exactly what the impact is going to be. But the right thing to do is to be prepared.
When you say his degree of uncertainty, there are quite a few people, including senior economists, who seem pretty certain about what the effect is now. So, for instance, Sir Howard Davis, former chair of NatWest, of course, deputy governor of the Bank of England, as he was as well, telling us yesterday, any suggestion the government is prepared to take the brakes off and splurge on public spending may result in even further increases in interest rates, which would leave us back where we started. In other words, there are economists saying the government will not be able to afford to provide the kind of support that you've just been talking about.
Well, I think what is certainly true is that we need to learn the lessons from past interventions. So if you look at what happened in the past with, you know, untargeted, unfunded interventions, that left us all with a bill to pay. Right. That put up debt. It had an impact on inflation and interest rates. We need to make sure we learn the lessons.
Right.
From the past.
If there is an intervention this time round, it will be funded rather than borrowed.
Well, no, we need to make sure that it's targeted. We need to make sure that we are.
Yeah. But what about that? However targeted it is, what about the actual funding of it? Are you saying that we would not borrow extra in order to do it for those reasons that Sir Howard Davis was making of the programme yesterday?
Well, look, any decisions we take would be within our fiscal rules and would be set out by the Chancellor in the normal way. But what's important for us is to balance that need to be ready, that need to intervene in a targeted way with fiscal responsibility.
But do you accept that what Sir Howard was saying, which is that you just don't have the fiscal headroom to spend more?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on what the intervention is going to be. The Chancellor is obviously making contingency plans, as I said, with the Prime Minister, and we'll keep an eye on the situation very closely in the months ahead. What I can point to go back to my original point, is, you know, people thinking about what's happening tomorrow, they know that their energy bills will come down.
Yeah, but again, in the very short term, with everyone telling them they're going to go up quite markedly in the future. So, and for that reason, plenty of other countries are already taking other actions. Australia cutting fuel tax, Poland, Italy, Spain, etc. Is the government considering in any sense soon doing things on the tax side that would assist people other than those changes you've outlined that bring down the energy price cap?
Well, can I just make an important point here, Justin, about why I think those measures I've already mentioned are important, not only because of the impact they will have, but in terms of understanding our response? Because, you know, this is not something that we've just come to late in terms of acknowledging that the cost of living pressures people face and the challenges over energy bills are a priority for people. This is something we knew when we were elected in 2024. So decisions we've taken throughout our time in office, decisions we took at the budget last November, were about helping people with the cost of living. Now, given what's happening in the Middle East, given the instability and the impact that has on bills, what we've done already is even more important. You know, so we haven't come late to this party. You know, we've been taking action to bring down the cost of living already. And now, given the instability coming from overseas, the extra resilience that we've built in by taking levies off bills to bring bills down from tomorrow, by extending the 5p fuel duty cut, all of that is decisions that we've taken already that put us in as strong a possible position to weather the storm ahead.
Is it remotely possible that fuel duty will go up as is currently planned in September? Can you rule that out now?
Well, look, I'm not going to speculate on future tax changes. Obviously, the Chancellor will set out any changes in the normal way. But the current 5p cut lasts until September, and the Chancellor is keeping a close eye on what's happening to the prices of fuel and to, obviously, the prices of energy more broadly.
We heard from another energy economist, former executive from BP, back on the programme on Saturday, who said this as well. There needs to be a government plan, he said, in case Hormuz doesn't open. They need to maximise the production of our own resources in the North Sea, and they need to work out who will get resources of whatever is available. Is that a fair point to make?
Well, I think what is a fair point to make is that the North Sea will play, you know, a really important part in our energy mix for decades to come.
Do we need to maximise what we can get out of it now?
Well, I think we need to make sure we have the right transition between North Sea oil and gas and independent homegrown sources of energy, wind, solar, nuclear across the country.
And when you say the right transition, does that mean a different transition to the one that we're currently planning, potentially, if Hormuz remains closed?
No, I think we've got the right plan, because let me give you a few important points to help explain this. You know, if we were to increase the production in the North Sea, that wouldn't have any impact on price, right? Because we're a price taker, so it wouldn't have any impact on price. If we started developing out a new oil field now, it would be a decade before it came online. So that would not be a short-term benefit. It wouldn't have an impact right away. What we are encouraging, what the Chancellor and I and others are encouraging, is investment in what's called tiebacks, which is production essentially linked to existing oil fields. That means that we can benefit from those oil fields. It can continue to play an important part in our energy mix for many years to come, whilst at the same time investing in the new wind and solar and nuclear across the country, sure, because that is the way to get energy independence in the long run.
I take your point about us being price takers, but I mean, the fact is that in the United States, and we were talking about this earlier in the programme, in the United States, prices are going up, but supply is secure because they've got their own supplies of oil and gas. And that is the point, isn't it? In a time of real crisis, actually, it's not just price, it's supply. And that is what we're potentially cutting off from ourselves.
Well, we know that we have a declining basin in the North Sea. And so the important thing for us is to make sure we've got the transition to be carried out in the right way. So we know that oil and gas will play an important role for years to come. We know that we have to shift to renewables, but we have to support the production in the meanwhile. And that's why I gave you the example of tiebacks. So that's where we're not opening new oil fields, but off existing oil fields, we're creating new production. So that means we get supply from oil and gas in the meanwhile, whilst making that transition to energy independence.
James Murray, Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Thank you.
It is now 24 minutes past eight. The cause of this energy shock is, of course, the war and that decision of the regime in Tehran to allow only what it regards as non-enemy ships and tankers to pass through it. Yesterday, Donald Trump was reported by the Wall Street Journal to be considering stopping the conflict, even if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened, and pressing allies in Europe and the Gulf to take the lead on reopening it, something the Prime Minister Keir Starmer said he was considering when he met with business leaders in Downing Street yesterday. Well, what might such a mission involve? Tom Sharp, the former naval commander, joins us now to go through the options. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can it, to put a simple question, can the Strait of Hormuz be reopened by force?
No, I don't think they can. I think the Houthis proved that over an 18-month period, and that's a much lower, much more simple threat. We tried to force our way through there. In the end, we ended up in a sort of uneasy compromise where we could just about protect ourselves. But I think what Iran has shown so far in this conflict is that it's much harder in the Strait of Hormuz. There are more threats in the air, surface and subsurface domain. And unless they agree to stop shooting or are told to stop shooting, those are two other options, then I think the third the least good option, the military one, where we make them stop, is unlikely to work.
If, however, what you want to do is police the safety of it after there's some sort of halfway house agreement on reopening it, what would you then want to do?
It really depends on what... I mean, Iran have control of this situation. I think that much is clear, and I think they will continue to do so going forward, because right now they're achieving their end states. I'm not saying they're winning, but they are achieving their end states. Control of the strait, control of the economy to an extent, and regime survival. So it's not in their interest right now to change this. And if the US was to walk away, and they've been building in off-ramps in their language throughout this, so it remains an option, were they to walk away, the likelihood of us, whoever us is in this situation, going to Iran saying, please, can you open the strait and so we can escort ships through, I find that very unlikely. And that's what we're talking about here. So in my view, it's a bit more binary than that. Either there's a threat, like now, in which case it's not safe to go in, like now, or there isn't a threat, in which case, why do we need a large group of coalition ships to escort tankers through? I'm sure there's a sliver in between those two, but I can't see
it. Well, it's a fascinating question, because the Prime Minister said he was talking to dozens of allies, and it appeared to mean people in Europe. We know that President Macron has sent forces to the region and been rather proud of doing so. We know also the Gulf states themselves would obviously have a direct interest in trying to reopen the straits. What do you think they're talking about?
Yeah, well, France is key in this. Where are Macron's ships, which was rather an impressive display when they all sailed out of the door very quickly after this kicked off. And as you say, the GCC has a significant voice in this. But you know, none of their ships are high-end capable. And that's not to be patronising, but in the current missile and drone threat, they wouldn't survive. I mean, the Arleigh Burkes wouldn't survive right now, which is why they're not doing it. So, but we also we want to demonstrate naval activity. And so there's no harm in having those ships there and working out what to do with them in the future. But if you look at it just kind of from that slightly binary perspective, the little sliver between threat and no threat is hard to envisage right now.
So finally, in conclusion, it seems to me, Tom Sharp, what you're saying is either Trump ends the war and opens them, or they don't open at all.
Well, they open for one of three reasons. Iran chooses to because they've struck a deal or there's a ceasefire. Again, very hard to envisage what that would look like right now because it's not in their interest. They're told to, China, someone else, but China probably, or they're made to. And I think the made to one is proving very, very difficult. So again, I'm afraid this really comes down to Iran and what they choose to do in the next weeks and months.
And what's interesting, just to bring you up to date on that, is they do choose to allow Chinese container ships through, because we've just had a report from the AFP news agency that two Chinese container ships were allowed to transit the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. So certain ships, certain tankers get through, others do not. Tom Sharp, thank you for joining us.
29 minutes past eight to the Sporties Cup.
Morning, thank you very much. Things move pretty quickly in football, and Tottenham have entered into advanced talks with Roberto De Zerbi, the former Brighton manager, who is now willing to take charge of the club immediately. It had been thought that his preference was to wait until the end of the season. One of England's World Cup group opponents, Ghana, has sacked their manager, Otto Addo, just 10 weeks before the tournament starts. Ghana have lost their last four friendly fixtures and didn't qualify for this year's Africa Cup of Nations. England face Japan tonight in their last friendly in this country before the World Cup. Scotland play Ivory Coast at the Hill Dickinson Stadium, and Wales host Northern Ireland in Cardiff. Now, the Premiership women's rugby season has reached its mid-season break, with women's Six Nations taking centre stage over the next few weeks. 6 months on from England winning the Women's Rugby Union World Cup, what have the knock-on effects been for the domestic game? Well, Genevieve Shaw is the Executive Chair of Premiership Women's Rugby. Morning, Genevieve.
Morning.
You took the position of starting the PWR season 3 weeks later than usual in order to hopefully capitalise on the World Cup. Turned out that England won the World Cup. How have the last 6 months been in terms of the reaction and the effects that you've seen?
Yeah, it's been incredible, really. And we've really seen that momentum from the World Cup final carry through all the way through into the start of our season, and then all the way through the winter, which is always a difficult time, you know, when it's cold and we had all that rain that we've had. But we've seen incredible growth numbers, millions more people watching us on broadcast. Thank you, BBC, and also on streaming and our other channels. And we're also seeing the attendances grow in the stadiums too.
Yeah, you do double header games in PWR, slightly more than you would see normally, I guess. Why does that work so well for your particular audience?
I think we see it's really started with the big game, and Harlequins started this a long time ago now. And so we had that big game at Christmas. We see the Quins fans really stream across the road to Twickenham and watch both games. And we've seen the other clubs now start to look at this, with Bristol taking over the Principality and Sarries taking over Tottenham, and really putting on a very different show. And I think that's what really helps. We see both the male and female athletes together, lots of live music, lots of entertainment, and just really changing how rugby's presented. And for the women's game, it means we just, a new audience sees us. So even the diehard fans of those clubs are not always able to make that time for another match every weekend. And so it really means tens of thousands of people are seeing our women's teams and our brilliant female athletes.
Yeah, I'll come back to some of those points in a bit, but there's also this idea that a strong rugby fan base doesn't always translate into instant success. I'm thinking Leicester Tiger Women's. There's still quite a gulf, isn't there, between the tiers that, you know, for newer sports is always an issue.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, we've seen we're a very different kind of league, because as you've seen in lots of women's sports, you know, we've created a league. It's not necessarily grown up through a huge playing base. So we have teams that have come in and basically take a franchise and are a brand new team. And Sale and Exeter did it a few years ago. And then in this round in 2023, Ealing Trailfinders and Leicester Tigers took two spots. And it is definitely been harder for Tigers. We're working really closely with the club. They've got a great management team there now, and they're really exciting plans for the future. But it isn't always easy. And I think that performance gap is going to take another year or two to bridge.
And are these the kind of things that you'll look at now? As I mentioned, it's the Women's Six Nations starting, so there's a bit of a break in the PWR season. What is your focus as the in the executive positions, your focus for the next few weeks?
Yeah, we don't get a break, unfortunately. Yeah, we've got a few things on our table at the moment. So we've got this slightly strange anomaly that we're nine teams. That's not normal in a league. You tend to want even numbers. So we're going to take a look at what size and shape the competition might transition into over the next few years. We don't want to be too traditional about it. We want to stay innovative. So we're going to sort of kick around quite a few new ideas. We'll come back to you when we've settled on those. And we've been doing a big piece of research on what stops and what might enable more elite female athletes to move into coaching.
Yeah.
And how do we get more sort of elite female coaches in PWR and across the game?
Okay, well, I think we probably will come back to you on all of those elements over the next few weeks. But thank you very much for talking to us. Genevieve Shaw, Executive Chair of Premiership Women's Rugby.
Carthy, thank you. The Life Scientific is on this morning at 9. Jim Al-Khalili can tell us more.
Good morning. As a child growing up in Western Kenya, Washington Yoto Ochieng once watched a plane cross the night sky and told his mother he dreamed of being on it. But he remembers her encouraging him to dream bigger. Today, he's a professor of engineering at Imperial College London and president of the Royal Institute of Navigation. His work has ranged from city traffic planning to advising the government on the technologies that underpin so much of modern life. I'll be talking to Washington about his inspirational upbringing, how GPS technology can get lost in cities, and the UK's plans for a sovereign satellite navigation system after the news at 9, or catch up on BBC Sounds.
To the weather, it's going to be a mainly cloudy start. Patchy light rain in places, occasionally bright spells elsewhere in the afternoon. Where is elsewhere? I suppose where it's not cloudy. I don't know.
It's all very clear. It is 25 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb, the weatherman, and Nick Robinson. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
It's emerged that the former BBC Radio 2 presenter Scott Mills was interviewed under caution in July 2018 about allegations of serious sexual offences against a teenage boy, but prosecutors decided the evidence threshold was not met and the investigation was closed in 2019. Scott Mills was sacked yesterday by the BBC over claims related to his personal conduct. It hasn't given any further details of the allegations, and it's not clear what, if any, role the police investigation played in the dismissal.
Sir Keir Starmer has given the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, 48 hours to call off the planned six-day strike in England or face losing 1,000 extra training places. The walkouts, which are part of a dispute over pay and jobs, are due to start in a week. The BMA told this programme issuing public threats wasn't a constructive way forward. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that the US-Israeli attacks are weakening Iran's leadership. He also said that more than half of his military aims in the war had been achieved without putting a timeline on when the conflict would end. China has said three of its ships made their way through the Strait of Hormuz yesterday. Iran has all but closed it during the war. Beijing has expressed gratitude to what it called the relevant parties for allowing safe passage of the vessels.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It's 24 minutes to nine now. Police officers should not have to police tweets. They should not police what's written in newspaper columns or intervene in everyday arguments. That's what ministers call the common sense thinking behind a new approach to so-called non-crime hate incidents, which led to the comedy writer Graham Linehan being arrested for his views on trans. But some are worried that what might be lost in this change is the original idea behind it, which dates back to the brutal and racist murder of Stephen Lawrence. The McPherson inquiry suggested a record should be kept of racist incidents which fell short of a crime in order to establish a pattern which might lead to more serious offences being caught, as Danny Stone, chief executive of the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust, recalls.
The racist murder of Stephen Lawrence led to an inquiry, a review of policing and procedures. And it was identified that whether it be organisationally, communally or individually, there needed to be some appreciation of the tensions that build and that can lead to harm. Non-crime hate incidents, they help bring intelligence, they help protect vulnerable people and they help show cumulative impact. The system needed changing. There's no disputing that. I think my major concern is the outcome here. Categorising non-crime hate incidents as antisocial behaviour will disincentivise reporting. People won't be considering that this is important as I think they do at the moment. I have a very real fear police won't have the intelligence they need, won't see the cumulative impact of incidents, and therefore won't be able to do preventative policing and stop people coming to harm.
Listening to that, Tom Harding is Assistant Chief Constable and Director of Operational Standards at the College of Policing, which has been looking into this. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
I think the simple question being asked is, how do you avoid throwing out the baby with the bathwater?
Well, I think just to say that the review and the review team, the McPherson report, was at the forefront of our minds throughout. And I can categorically say that all the recommendations made in that review and inquiry will remain in place for policing, and that we will still capture vital intelligence about racism and incidents that policing should know about to prevent harm. It's at the very thrust of our recommendations.
So what will change now? What is it that you won't be recording that you were before?
So the key recommendation we've made is around the incident threshold. So when policing is required to record information from the public. At the moment, it's if someone has a cause for concern. We've recommended that that is changed to that there needs to be a clear policing purpose. So that's the prevention and detection of crime, safeguarding individuals. You know, I think those are the matters that the public expect us. And as policing, we want to be invested in and involved in. And that means that the concerns around hatred, we expect that we will hopefully deliver more intelligence about those individuals who are going to cause harm or commit crimes moving forward.
Now, the reason this is so sensitive and so difficult to get right is it's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? There are some people who think that, for example, that what Graham Linehan said about trans was a perfectly legitimate expression, albeit a rather angry and offensive to many expression of views on a public controversy. Others thought it was much more than that, thought it was the beginning of hateful and therefore threatening behaviour. How will you decide what does and doesn't have a clear policing purpose?
Well, first, I think it highlights how difficult a job my fantastic colleagues across the country have when, as individuals, they have to make an assessment of what is reported to them. So our proposals that we put forward are that we will train up a large number of individuals across the country who are doing their day jobs in control rooms and in other teams to ensure that they understand that the new rules that we've put in place. And there's going to be a really clear focus on, is there a policing purpose to what it is that we record? And as I've said, they'll need to assess, is this about preventing future crime? Is this about protecting and safeguarding an individual? So again, some lawful expression online that people or otherwise that people might not like, you know, we won't record that. But if that is directed at an individual or if there is a risk of harm or future crimes, then of course it will. We've seen horrific attacks over recent weeks and months driven by ideologies. It's clear that we will continue to investigate and to identify where someone may have such concerning ideologies.
Well, you say it's clear, but it hasn't convinced the chief executive of the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust, who we heard just a moment ago. And actually, a number of people raised voices in the House of Lords with their concerns about this. And indeed, Stephen Lawrence's own father is quoted in an interview in the Daily Mirror saying that he is not reassured. Let me give you finally, just one specific example. Take the British Jewish community, who are facing record levels of abuse. If somebody rings the police now and says, I was spat at, I was shouted at, I am being attacked online, not occasionally, but being targeted online, how can they be sure that if that was not reaching the threshold for criminal action, it would nevertheless be recorded in case something worse was to happen later?
I think let's be clear, the reports only come out today. We're committed to working with all of those groups to explain. And the examples that you've used will absolutely be recorded. A number of those are crimes that would be recorded as criminal offences. Other elements might not, but they would still be recorded in our systems. We would know that they were based on the fact that that individual has a religion, and we will tackle that as robustly as we can. And that is what we're proposing today, is to free up time from lawful debate, and we will invest that time back into where harm is being caused in communities.
Tom Harding of the College of Policing, thank you for joining us.
18 minutes to nine. Britain is not fighting Iran, of course, but British jets have been flying defensive missions over Cyprus, over Jordan, Qatar, Bahrain for the past month now, ever since the US and Israel began their bombing campaign against Iran. They've clocked up more than 1,000 hours of flying, and indeed they have shot down several drones. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale is one of the first journalists to join an RAF refuelling tanker for these missions. He sent his report from RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, a base that's already itself been targeted by a drone.
A typhoon jet rips through the night sky above RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus. Followed by the heavier rumble of a Voyager refueling tanker, which we've joined on a mission to hunt down Iranian drones.
Positive climb, you're up.
Soon the shimmering lights of Cyprus fade into the distance. And for the crew in the Voyager, signs of a war still raging.
Over in that direction, you've got the Israel-Lebanon coast. So quite often you can see either incoming missiles from Iran or the Israeli response going up to that as well.
So we just saw a flash of orange there. That could have been a missile going up or going down.
Potentially, yep.
We are steady in the turn.
Roger.
Proof Iran is still a threat after a month of heavy US and Israeli bombing.
We're safe here. We're safe here. It's very much targeted at that area as opposed to the Isle of Cyprus.
Yeah, it might be the Iron Dome from Israel or something else. So we don't necessarily know that. There's just a lot of kinetic things happening in the area at the moment.
The Typhoon and an F-35 refuel several times from this petrol station in the sky, after looking for targets.
2-2, go echelon right, you've had £8,800.
Range 2-2.
2-2, disconnect.
Range 2-2.
This time, they find none. But British jets have shot down several drones. On the ground, an F-35 pilot explains it's no easy task, with the drones flying low and slow.
There are lots of risks, as you might expect, as operating a fast jet is a dangerous business, let alone if you're trying to do targeting close to the surface of the land or the sea, and integrate with a lot of other assets in what might be a complicated scenario that's evolving very rapidly.
Akrotiri's defences were bolstered before the war started. But there have been reinforcements after a drone hit the base, including helicopters carrying air defence missiles, in addition to the armoured vehicles fitted with the same. I asked Major General Tom Buick, the commander of British Forces Cyprus, whether it's enough to deter Iran from trying to carry out any future attack.
All I'll say is that the amount of capability that we have got deployed out here means that I am as sure as I can be that we're in a good place.
You do not think this base will be attacked again by...
It could easily be attacked again. I'm not saying it's been attacked once, so I'd be a fool to say it's not going to be attacked again. What I'm saying is that given the amount of warning out there and the air defence assets we've got in place, we're as well protected as we can be.
Visual, I think we've got you on TCAS at the moment, 8,000 feet below, 20 miles. We're going to start a left-hand turn for you.
Roger.
British jets have been flying these defensive missions for a month now. But when and how this war ends is out of their hands. This could become another enduring commitment for an already stretched British armed forces.
Johnny Beale reporting from Cyprus.
It is coming up to 13 minutes to nine now. Chefs who shout at their staff, macho behaviour, punishing hours. It is not easy to be a woman in a professional kitchen. Now restaurateurs are being urged to sign up to a pledge to protect women in the industry by one of the stars of that industry, Michelin star chef Sally Abbe, who joins us in the studio, which is rather good for you, given you've just opened a new bistro in Hackney and probably quite busy at the moment. Welcome to the Today programme. What is it that this charter says?
So it's basically a 10-point document of things that we as women want to see change in the industry. And it's basically a commitment for restaurateurs to make to say that they are actually going to be part of making that change.
And what inspired you to do it? Because you've worked in the industry a long time. You worked under Gordon Ramsay, who famously is quite shouty.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think he, was quite shouty a long time ago, but has certainly come a long, long way from there. I think the sort of turning point for us was a news article that came out actually this time last year of a chef saying he'd not seen any sexism in kitchens, and that prompted me and 70 other female chefs to write an open letter to the press to express our disappointment in that statement and also say we wanted change.
When you said express disappointment, can I suggest that off air you probably shouted and screamed saying, what do you mean?
I'm being diplomatic.
Yeah. And it is the distinction, though, that you're making, and an important one, I imagine, between, yes, a high-stress environment at which occasionally voices will be raised and unacceptable or sexist behaviour.
Absolutely. I mean, I think working in kitchens and hospitality in general is very high pressured, and there's no getting away from that. It's now. The food has to go out to the guest as quickly as possible. But that doesn't mean in any world that you should then treat your staff poorly as a result of that. One shouldn't coexist with the other.
When you saw that claim that there wasn't sexism in the industry, did you think back of experiences that you had had and think maybe I should never have had to have those experiences and perhaps even should have had the support of others to call them out?
Yes, absolutely. I experienced a lot of things in my time as a younger chef that I sort of brushed under the carpet, pretended that it didn't happen, you know, was told just to leave it or just to forget about it. And I think a lot of many women have experienced this as well. And this is what this pledge is for, to call time on that and say, no, we won't stand for it anymore. It's now a zero tolerance policy.
And yes, you've got the support of those 70 women first, but have you crucially got the support of men? Because I imagine that is what you need for this to make a real difference.
Well, and this is exactly it. That's the most important part. We can shout and scream for change as much as we want, but unless we've got male allies, they're the ones that hold the power, as there are more of them in senior management positions. So we need men to be allies and to get on board with this and help make that change.
And presumably it is also part not just of a culture change, not just of calling things out, but of education. How do you get what you want to happen in that high-pressure environment without losing your temper, without abusing somebody?
Well, exactly, and that's part of the reason that we've created this pledge, because, you know, not all people are aware of things that happen and experiences that women have. So we've spelt that out in a 10-point pledge, and, you know, someone could read that and say, oh, I didn't I didn't realise. And, you know, whether that's their fault or not is another story. But now they've got it spelled out in black and white in front of them. So they are able to read that and then think, how can I help implement that change?
Sally, as we got you in the studio, we're talking a lot of the pressures on the economy at the moment because of the conflict in the Middle East. Have you noticed a change as you open a new bistro in East London with your other outlets? Are you already noticing that customers are willing to spend less than they were, or being more cautious about eating out?
I mean, I think it's the cost of living crisis has been rising and rising for some time now. Obviously, the war is only going to sort of compound that. You know, I think the biggest thing as a worry for us is obviously energy bills. You know, gas and electricity prices for restaurants are already, you know, 400% higher in some cases than they were 5 or 6 years ago. So, yeah, it's certainly a worry.
Sally Abbey, Michelin star chef, who is behind that 10-point plan and pledge. Thanks very much for coming to the studio.
9 minutes to 9 is the time. Just to say, coming up on Radio 4 this morning, Inside Health is going to be looking at a non-hormonal drug which is now approved to treat menopausal hot flushes. So James Gallagher is going to be exploring the evidence with the resident GP, Dr. Margaret McCartney, who finds out what it is like to have a hot flush. It's Inside Health, which comes up this morning at 9:30. We turn now, though, to bees. Listen to this.
One final problem to solve. How to hide the shell. And the way she does that has earned her the nickname the Broomstick Bee. Like a mini Harry Potter, she carries stick after stick back to her shell.
That is an excerpt from a new instalment in National Geographic's Secrets of series. And this time, as you will have gathered, it's bees. And Bertie Gregory is the BAFTA and Emmy award-winning National Geographic explorer, host and narrator of Secrets of the Bees, and joins us now. Morning to you.
Good morning.
And some of those secrets sound quite out there. I mean, that was fascinating. But we were playing a clip earlier on in the programme as well of a kind of huge heat being created by the bees.
So that's the Asian honeybee, and they have an incredible defensive strategy because they're hunted by these enormous murder hornets. So these bright orange hornets, and the hornets, as well as attacking the adult bees, their goal is really to break into the hive and try and steal the honeybees' young. And so, yeah, they basically work together as a team, and they are many, many times smaller than the hornets that are trying to break into the hive. And they'll basically all collectively rush the hornet, and they'll give it a big hug, and then they all start to vibrate their bodies, and the heat they collectively generate is enough to actually fry the hornet and kill it. So yeah, bees, if you think you know bees, I promise you don't.
Did you come close enough to them yourself to be stung? Because it's always an operational issue, isn't it, with bees? But you were getting close.
It is sort of a real challenge. And whilst I would say bees, you know, have a reputation for being very stingy, they're really not. They don't want to sting you. It's a defensive strategy, and when you spend a huge amount of time with them, like we did for this series, occasionally you're going to get unlucky, you're going to make mistakes. And I had one, his legs actually got caught in my eyebrow hair, and I sort of flinched, and it tugged at his body, and it stung me in the face, and yeah, I couldn't see out of my right eye for about 3 days.
We should say as well, the whole thing executive produced by James Cameron, the film director.
That's correct. So he's been part of this Secrets of series since the beginning, when the series started with Secrets of the Whales quite a few years ago. And I think it's really exciting to have, you know, I can't think of many Hollywood directors that have made as many huge iconic movies as he has. And he, you know, works with our huge team to make sure that, you know, we are appealing to people's heads and their hearts and reaching as many people as possible. I should also say that James Cameron has a particular affinity for bees because he is actually a beekeeper himself.
Oh,
so
right.
that was a fun part of the process.
And when you say our heads and our hearts, do they capture your heart? Because, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, the programs about big furry animals and all the rest of it obviously capture people's hearts. But do
sure.
bees?
Yeah, I mean, I should say I have been, you know, spent the last decade or so being sent off by National Geographic to very far away places to film exactly those big furry animals you're talking about, you know, wolves, mountain lions, polar bears. And I thought coming into this bee series that we'd kind of struggle to find that kind of charisma, that character. But I was completely wrong. As soon as you get down on their level and see kind of the world on their scale, suddenly there's all these dramas playing out that, you know, are just as exciting as any kind of African savannah. And, you know, we harnessed new technology to allow us to do that, but then, you know, also relied, like we always do, on kind of old school field craft and really learning the habits and the ways of the bees.
Is that part of it? That you're not seeing, I mean, when we talk about insects, generally we talk about sort of swarms of them or large numbers of them. We don't become close to them. Is what you are doing with bees introducing us to individuals and their relationships and struggles, etc.?
Totally. Well, I mean, of course, just on a biological level, the bees like honeybees, both here in Europe and the Asian honeybees that I mentioned earlier, they of course live in these big, you know, these big hives, big colonies. But they are just, you know, two species of bee. There are in fact 20,000 species of bee around the world. Just here in the UK, we've got nearly 300, and many of them don't live in these big families. They are individuals. So telling that individual story is almost easier in a way because there's only one of them. And I think key to that, as I mentioned, is technology. And we were utilizing this lens called a probe lens. It kind of looks like a sort of weird medical instrument. It's about 2 feet long. It's got this long, narrow barrel. And it basically gets you very up close to the bees, just like a kind of a traditional close-up macro lens, we call it. But it also is then wide angle. So as well as getting you down onto their scale, it shows the subject, the little insect within its world. So suddenly, you know, the little bee with a daisy behind it that's just a couple centimeters tall. Well, in the frame, that daisy looks like a skyscraper because that's what it looks like to the bee.
How long did it take you to do it all?
So it was a huge, huge team effort. I am a small cog in a very large machine, but we were filming for 3 years.
3 years?
We went 3 years. Wow. So we went all over the world. The kind of core of the film follows a honeybee hive actually in Dorset. But as I mentioned, yeah, we cover bees all over the place.
Do you have a sense of where this fits into generally? So this is part of a series, isn't it? Is it your understanding that what you've done now is going to be is going to change people's knowledge of bees? Because that, I mean, I suppose there are two ways of looking at all of these series, isn't there? It's just interesting, and you can look at it as an outsider and say, goodness, I didn't know X, Y, or Z about that species. Or in some cases, and I'm thinking, I suppose maybe with sharks, it actually changes the way we think about the species.
Totally. Well, I really hope that people fall in love with bees and kind of reopen their eyes to them. But I think, you know, you brought up sharks. You know, that is an animal like the bees that is in big trouble globally. But I guess when I make a wildlife film with these, you know, huge, amazing teams, we're always trying to, you know, get people to fall in love with the animal we're filming. And then we're going to make them aware of some of the challenges they face and maybe some things that, you know, you can do in your daily life that might help that animal. The problem with a lot of the films that I'm involved in, I find, is that, you know, we tell people about an animal that lives far away and faces challenges that are far away. And yes, you know, for example, when it comes to the polar bear, you know, if I told you, okay, the polar bears are in trouble, that's because, you know, their sea ice is melting. And these are some of the things you can do in your daily life to help that. I would really